and Public Safety Finance Division of Wednesday, April 15th, 2015. Quorum is present. Senator Sharon, thank you for your patience. Senate File 1292.
Mr. Chair?
Than we thought. Yes.
I'm just Senator a little Kimmel. Bit confused uh-huh. that you took a vote on a bill uh-huh. prior to calling the committee to order. Are we in any
Senator Kiffmeyer, we had called the policy committee.
Oh, I see. Policy to. Yeah. I was just looking at our agenda. Oh. He's on the finance agenda. This bill.
Right. Yeah. We decided to go ahead and get a committee position on what it was a policy bill only, unless we find out differently, Senator Peterson, that it's finance in it. But
okay.
To get it,
I get
move
it, now.
It to the floor.
Okay.
Great. Thanks.
It was on finance agenda.
So members. Senate File 1292, just so you're aware, I believe was modified in HHS Finance, but we don't have the engrossed committee report or the engrossed version of the bill in front of us because they laid it on the table for possible inclusion. Is that right? And so now we have. So the current version, you'll have to just engross for yourself this amendment A4 that's in your packet along with 1292. The big version of the bill here. So that's what we're working off of. Senator Sharon.
Yes, thank you. Just to be clear, everything is the same in 1292 in the first engrossment that we have. What we added was an amendment that simply adds to that initial bill then clarification that the fees that are collected in the bill for the inspections of vehicles, which is a $45 fee, is collected and then deposited in the Trunk Highway Fund, and from there is appropriated to the Commissioner of Transportation. So it was clarifying language to be clear about the pathway for the $45 decal fee. So if there aren't any questions about that, and may I ask, the sections of the bill that we are focused on today, we've been through your policy committee, and we're now
right.
here as part of finance committee, are sections 1, 2, 3, and 4 of the of the bill. And so I, if you would like, I can summarize those, and then I want to talk about the fiscal note.
Sure.
Is that how you'd like us to proceed?
Sure, yeah. We had a pretty thorough discussion in policy, so just kind of bounce off the mountaintops and
so I'll just give a very high level reminder that in these portions of the bill 1, 2, 3, and 4 those sections it talks about non-emergency medical transportation services defining those it allows the Commissioner of Transportation to inspect the safety features required in the vehicles that are designated for non-emergency medical transportation and protected transport. It requires the medical transportation providers to pay a $45 annual inspection fee and obtain a decal for the and as a result of possessing that, they're eligible for a number of opportunities, which are included in a letter that I wanted you all to have a chance to see or read that identifies what the $45 decal will do for the providers. It gives them access to a number of resources and opportunities. And I think that and the amendment says where the money is going to go and how it's going to be utilized. Oh, and then in Section 4 simply provides with some language that the department wanted in case the workload was such and provided the language that would allow them to extend a variance should they not be able to meet the inspection process in a timely way. And that's, in essence, what this is about. The fiscal note, you should have a revised fiscal note. I'm hoping that you do. And in it, it shows that the cost for the biennium is $39,000. But in the second year of the biennium, there's an expected $12,000 savings, so the overall cost is $27,000, and that is paid for by this $45 fee collected and that provides the decal for the providers. I have with me persons who have been engaged in this long process of working out issues related to non-emergency medical transportation, and they're here to comment or answer your questions, whichever your preference would be.
I think we have a thorough understanding, and we'll just ask questions. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a handout here, the NEMT certification decal, and I just have a question. It says, furthermore, it will curtail rogue providers. Could you tell me what a rogue provider would be? It's not in the bill, but it is in a handout from the NEMT Advisory Committee member. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Abderholden, please introduce yourself.
Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. A rogue driver would be someone who actually did not get certified but is pretending to be an NEMT provider. And so the decal makes it clear to any person who's using that transportation that, in fact, they've had their background checked, their vehicle has been inspected, that type of thing.
Okay.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, I'm also concerned because of the Health and Human Services budget and payment, because it also says many of these modes offer increased reimbursement rates. So it looks like this will also increase costs in regard to these providers. Can you explain how there would be an increased cost here with this decal?
Senator Sharon.
I'm not exactly certain what your question is. In the HHS portion of the fiscal note, there are increased rates for various modes and for persons who drive themselves and for volunteer providers that are also articulated in the fiscal note, but they are not a part of the Department of Transportation's. The $45 fee is for a decal that articulates to the consumers as well as to the providers that they've met the standards that have been established by the Department of Transportation.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think the issue that I'm making here just that if you increase reimbursement rates, you increase the costs of providing the service.
So, Senator Kiffmeyer, is your question that will more rides at this higher rate be generated, or I don't think that's the gist of the sentence, but I'll let those who prepared this handout.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems as though the requirement.
In bullet point number 3, correct?
Yes.
All right.
It seems as though if everybody's going to be required to have this decal, and only with this can everybody's going to be getting that higher reimbursement rate.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Sue, after holding with NAMI. You can only go into a higher mode of transportation if you've been assessed to need that mode. What would happen here, though, is that with the new modes that were recommended by the task force to meet the suggestion recommendations of the OLA report, we got rid of the what used to be called ATS and STS providers because some people needed help just to their door, some people needed help through their door, and that made that differentiation. But to most of us, we don't understand how that can really be a difference. So that would no longer be the case. You would just need assisted transport. It wouldn't be, curb to curb or door to door or through the door or anything like that. So there might be some providers who currently were ATS who might be helping some people who would have formerly been in STS, and in that situation they could perhaps get a higher mode because they're providing a higher amount of assistance.
Thank you. I still have my concern, but that's right. Enough for the question,
Mr.
Chairman.
I think I understand the question, and I think I have an answer, which I will articulate, and I'll ask Senator Sharon to let me know if I got it right. So as I understand the point of the second sentence in this third bullet, many of these modes offer increased reimbursement rates and allows providers to expand their services to meet the demand of these additional modes. So there would not necessarily be more rides overall being offered per se at a reimbursement rate that is higher. Rather, there would be more providers available to provide these already existing rides that we have in Minnesota. So more providers would be. This is an established rate. It's not an increased rate. It's established rate, but it's higher than what they would normally be able to charge if it were, for example, just a normal taxi cab ride. Is that correct?
Yes, there's variations. I didn't go in through all of the reforms that are in last year and in this year's bill. I'm sorry, we're just sort of focusing on the transportation components of this, but The modes are determined based on the client's level of need, and there's an assessment process that's done to make certain that the appropriate mode is defined for that person for them to be safely transported, but not at a mode, in a more expensive mode, if a less expensive mode can be established. And that's all indicated through the policy changes that we passed through or will pass and fund if they get funded through the Department of Human Services. This only relates to the providers getting their vehicles reviewed, making certain that they meet safety requirements, and that they receive a decal indicating that. And if they meet those safety requirements, then they're eligible to be a provider for these various modes. They can compete with each other for those rides. But it doesn't increase the rides, only those, right. The overall volume of rides is dependent on those who are on medical assistance, and because it is a privilege under the medical assistance privileges, and then on an assessment of which of a variety of modes they're eligible for. These providers simply have to meet some standards in order to compete for that business.
So, for example, to transport someone who is frail or fragile, they need a certain type of vehicle and a certain type of training, and a certain reimbursement rate follows that.
Right. It recognizes the complexity of the service for that particular need, as opposed to somebody a volunteer driver or somebody driving themselves or a bus, which
right.
is one of the other options that can be given to a person on medical assistance to get transportation to a medical appointment.
But that's reimbursed at a lower rate. All right. Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having served on HHS for 6 years, it was kind of fun to talk HHS just for a little bit and to see all three of you again. I don't get to see you too often. And I still have some questions, but I will defer to this is a bill. This is transportation. Mm-hmm. We're here for a specific purpose. So I'll just go offline and
all right.
ask a couple others from you, okay?
Thanks. The Senator Westrom, and then Senator Peters.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I'm thinking you might have been out of the room at the time we had this in policy committee, but I think to answer your question, and the rogue drivers, this bill is limiting the number of providers, or will make it harder, a little harder for providers. So my reading of that is they're referring to rogue providers would be people that are doing it maybe now but don't go through the new licensing process and pay the fee to get it done. But wouldn't that be right, Senator Sharon? Anybody from now on would have to go through this inspection annually.
Senator Sharon.
That is correct.
And so I think to Senator your West. Question, I think that's some of the concerns I raised at the last committee is I think this bill could have an unintended consequence of raising prices but limiting providers because there's some people, especially if their business model is only a part of this type of transport, that would choose not to go through the annual inspection and fee process. And so I have had some of my questions answered since then. I still am a little reluctant to go with an annual fee inspection, but Senator Kiffmeyer, I think that's the issue you were talking about. If I heard and understood you right, I think that is the net result is there would be less providers, and there would be anybody that did it without this license would be called a rogue provider and probably not somebody that's legally allowed to transport a person. Although, Senator Sharon, a couple of questions it raises for me.
May I just follow up on that before you ask another question?
Yep,
for sure.
The rogue is a term that was used by in this particular letter. It's not coming from our materials.
Right.
But it is true that the decal allows us to make certain that the providers are meeting the standards for safety. And the $45 is to cover the cost of that inspection rather than another source of revenue. But aside from the word rogue, what I would hope you would see in this letter from the our 80 corridor members is the number of advantages that a provider gets as a result of expending $45, which includes they can purchase a license plate that saves them up to $250 a year, and they are able to be eligible for state fuel tax rebates that can save on average about $800 a year. So there's a, and that's not all that's listed here, but there's a number of opportunities that occur for the providers with the managed care organizations that would not occur otherwise. And in addition, the consumer, for the consumer, that's for the provider, the consumer with this becomes able to utilize other other elements that we've worked out in this reform, which includes the ability to complain and go through, and, and we can exercise actions against a complaint if somebody is terribly impolite or rude or mistreats a client or whose vehicle does not meet reasonable standards. There's a process in place for the consumer as a result of these initiatives. So this, there's many advantages to this that far outweigh the $45 expenditure.
Mr. Senator Westrom. Senator Sharon, just to that, to a couple of those points you raised, just for clarification. So the license plate is a cheaper license plate they can buy because of hauling these types of clients, and what's, you mentioned the $800 savings over something else. Can you explain those just a little bit more, and then I have the follow-up questions I have.
Senator Sharon.
Mr. McAlpin would like to speak to this issue to confirm what I was saying.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, Buck McAlpin, Minnesota Ambulance Association. Correct, Mr. Senator Westrom, that we get those plates for ambulances also for our fuel tax rebates, and this also allows things that when we're DOT and DHS certified, that it is a lower fee plate that we pay for working in that Medicaid space and taking care of that large population of clientele, and it favors us some things from the state in regards to fuel tax refunds and the lower license plate fees.
So,
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McAlpine, so are, what's the difference from somebody now newly licensed or with a sticker versus currently today? What are those vehicles doing? Are they just licensed with the standard Minnesota license plate? They don't qualify for these tax, I forget what you call them, tax credit credits, but they would now, all of these new drivers with the right license plate or decal?
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, that's exactly the direction we want to go with this, is we have a baseline of credentialing, and there is some folks that are credentialed and some that are not, and the ones that are not do not receive those benefits.
Okay. So,
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, today some providers are credentialed, some are not. And after this would put everybody, they'd have to be in the credentialed category or they couldn't provide the service.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, that's correct.
Okay. And so,
Senator Westrom.
Senator Sharon, you talked about the reimbursements. Now that's if you hire a company to transport non-emergency medical for non-emergency medical reasons. There's also an ability, and this bill raises the reimbursement for reimbursing a person or their family or a friend for driving for that appointment or the volunteers. Now, do those cars have to have the same type of decal, or is it, or what do they have if they're going to use a volunteer driver through the social services or a family or a friend's car that they would get the reimbursement rate allowed under this bill?
Senator Sharon.
Ms. Abderholden would like to answer that question.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, no, they don't have to be certified. Many of the counties, as you know, do make sure the volunteers have a background check and of that nature, but particularly for a person's own vehicle or if their family's driving them, we're not requiring them to be certified.
And
Senator Westrom.
And so Mr. Chair, the family isn't, or the volunteer's vehicle is not either? Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, as far as I know with the volunteer, I'm starting to get a little out of my, I know a lot more about human services, but I don't believe that they all have to be certified. I think there are some, you know, kind of larger counties perhaps that do, but I don't believe that they all do.
And so, Mr. Chair, and then back to the decal or the certification. Currently, can you tell us what is the process for somebody? Primarily, we're talking about Category 3 here, where it's not a family, it's not themselves or a family member or a friend that's driving them that gets reimbursed. It's not level, I'll call that level 1. We got level 2, which is a volunteer driver who is helping somebody make their appointment, but they're driving for them. They're getting reimbursed per mile. And that's level 2. Now we've got level 3, which is what we're really looking at here, which is a decal. Now, on anybody that's in that level 3 category to transport a non-emergency medical patient or customer. What is the current status of that? Those vehicles are in level 3 with or without a decal at this point in time. They all get similar reimbursement, but basically a reimbursement that would pay for the company to own the vehicle and driver and all of those expenses.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's actually a difficult question to answer because at that level, there's actually a few more. You might have a van that is lift-equipped, which currently has a decal. And so some of the more accessible vans or vehicles already have that decal. So what we're looking at were the vehicles that we used to call or still call until the law gets through human services, ATS. But STS have always been certified and always had the decal. So this is just a smaller number of vehicles that either transported people, might have been a cab or a van or something of that sort, but they did not, because they only provided help to the door and not through the door or just curb to curb, they were not required to have a decal for their vehicle or get certified as a special transportation provider in the past. So this is just saying that anyone now who is doing medical assistance, reimbursed transportation, has to have that.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator West,
STS, you just said, what's ATS stand for then?
Alternative Transportation System.
System. Okay.
Or Accessible Transportation System. Maybe, I'm sorry, we're going now into order to answer your question, Senator, we're going into talking about the single administrative structure, which is a recommendation from the auditor, to move away from a system that used to have an ATS system, assisted transportation system, I think it was called, and then the special transportation system. Then there's the ambulance system. And they wanted a single administrative structure. The difficulties that we've had in the past were around all the definitions of who would get an ATS ride or who would get an STS ride. And it required an assessment process from the distance that did not take into account the unique needs of the patient, because it was a distance assessment, and also the unique character of the state in terms of what kind of transportation provisions were allowable or what were accessible to that client. So we've changed all of that language. We don't use ATS or STS anymore. We use modes of transportation,
right,
and we define behaviorally what each mode's supposed to, you know, the needs of the client based are described behaviorally in order to be eligible for that mode. And it describes both physical and cognitive limitations. And then we do an assessment to determine which mode that person fits, trying to get the right one, but at the most efficient one. And we also are trying in the modes to reduce the frequency with which assessments occur, which was a costly, unnecessary thing, and eliminate some of the there were perverse incentives in the system for moving somebody from STS to ATS and back and forth. So it's hard to answer your question, Senator, because there's so much other reform underneath the question that you're asking. But essential question is the volunteers and the self-drivers, if they're capable of taking somebody and somebody wants to take that risk, they can. But in order to get reimbursed for, through medical assistance and utilize any of the other modes, that those vehicles have to have an inspection at the Department of Transportation.
And Mr. Chair, two points, and I think I'm done here. But the issue that I see still is, and I think what we were mostly referring to is the non-ambulatory, so somebody that needs a wheelchair or assistance in that regards, is already decaled. You're mainly talking more the ambulatory person who might be disabled but can ride in a regular car for all intents and purposes, and that's what you're trying to wrap into the decal, if I understand it right. That's one of the big changes in
well, that would be true, but there are also persons under the current system who are wheelchair dependent who, when assessed, are asked the question, can you get to the curb by yourself? Mm-hmm. And if you can, then that may mean that you get a lower level, an ATS level of service. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's not just ambulatory persons. There may be persons who are not, from a physical disability perspective, ambulatory, but would still be eligible for an ATS service if they can lift themselves out of their chair into the car, for example. And and so we've changed that in our descriptors of the various modes. So it does ask ATS providers, because they do provide services for non-ambulatory persons, to meet specifications and requirements. But we are aware that in doing so, the $45 fee is offset by a number of the other economic benefits that come with having that decal.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, that's the bigger problem I have. I think Senator Kiffmeyer kind of put her finger on it. Maybe this is the right direction to go. I'm still cautious in the sense that it's going to limit the interest from those, especially in rural Minnesota areas where you might have a taxi cab company that this is, as I told you in the last committee, 10 or 20% of their business. But to the fee, is there a reason we have to do this annually? I mean, once a vehicle's inspected, could we at least not burden the party with an annual fee and an inspection, maybe every 2 or 3 or 4 years? Have you looked at that at all? And I'll sit and wait for your answer. It might be just a suggestion I would have as you consider this continuing to move to the floor.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, you know, we looked at the we have to remember in rural Minnesota, and one reason why the Ambulance Association has always been so passionate to work with R80 and the last rural group, is we have very few large non-emergency transportation providers in rural Minnesota. And the ones that we do have followed some very stringent standards around credentialing and certifying. When we go get grandma, she's getting a very credentialed, safe vehicle to get home. Whether you're in the ambulance industry, we relicense every year and go through a process to be sure our ambulances are safe and sound. Some of these vehicles we see going down the road are pretty darn scary. And what we've worked on with this large group of the non-emergency advisory group that Sue chairs here is to be sure that let's bring someone into some basic standards. And the R80, the Ambulance Association, that entire committee and the counties felt very comfortable that that $45 fee with the benefits you would receive are very easy to support to be in that Medicaid space and to be sure that our vulnerable patients are transported appropriately.
All right. Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, when you were before us earlier, we had testimony in regards to the number of new inspectors that were going to be needed. And I see that MnDOT is asking for an additional 1.5 FTEs to do these increased inspections. I don't recall how long it takes to do one of these inspections. Do you recall or have a sense for how long it takes?
Thank you, Senator. You know, I'm going to ask the department to come up and answer that, because I do remember you were talking about this. That's what the fee covers, is those costs. But a part of your question, if I remember correctly, is how are these inspections done, how quickly? That's why we have some language in there that allows for a variance in getting the decal if the department's not able to be responsive enough to get a request for this decal if they can't get it done in a timely way. We figure 6 months allows the department to meet those demands throughout the state for what's anticipated here. But the other part of your question, and I think I heard this during the hearings, and I would ask the department to come, is that they do send inspect. They don't. The provider doesn't have to come to the metropolitan area for this. You know, the department reaches out to accomplish this, and that was another part of what you had asked about. And I was checking on that, so I just refer to the department to answer that question more thoroughly.
Ms. Rhodes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Laura Rhodes, MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. Our office also regulates special transportation service providers. To your question, Senator Peterson, about inspections, each inspection or each vehicle, probably the inspection takes 30 to 45 minutes per vehicle. That time, for one provider varies depending on the size of the fleet. And what would account for that is obviously the additional vehicles. Part of what we also do is a records review or an audit. And so depending on the number of drivers that a provider has, that would be, additional driver files that our inspectors would be reviewing.
So Mr. Chair and Ms. Rhodes, currently now with commercial vehicles, if I recall correctly, the company can hire their own mechanic and do kind of their own Department of Transportation certification on their own vehicles. Is that correct?
Ms. Rhodes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, for commercial motor vehicles, is that what you mean?
Yes.
Correct.
So Mr. Chair and Ms. Rhodes, why wouldn't you do that same scenario here if they have somebody that can do their own inspections?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I think the idea there is that these vehicles, some of them have different and specialized equipment, such as wheelchair securement devices or wheelchair ramps. And so those inspectors that you mentioned for the commercial motor vehicles, that's a program with in conjunction with the Minnesota State Patrol. So those inspectors go through some sort of class through the State Patrol and are able to inspect commercial motor vehicles. And I think the idea here is that some of these vehicles have specialized equipment that it requires additional or specialized training. The inspectors that we have to go through certain training to be able to become certified to actually do STS inspections, and I think that is more of a more involved, in-depth training process than what it would be for those commercial motor vehicle inspectors certified by the State Patrol.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Rhodes. I think I understand what you're saying there in regards to the lift. The only thing I would argue that there's just as much variety in commercial vehicles when you look at mounted forklifts, when you look at soft-sided vans that have their own tarps that come down, built on the frame with conventional vans. There is many variances in commercial vehicles as well, and so it seems that there's some differences here. But the other, I was just doing the math here, and so this basically previously, before the new expanded, you're saying that you're going to do 900 more inspections with this new decal than you are right now. And so you do the math on that, that's about 3 inspections a day, based on a 250 working day. Does that seem like a heavy load or a light load or medium load for your inspectors in terms of doing, just based on the math, that's 3 inspections a day?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson.
Ms. Rhodes.
As of January 2015, MnDOT had 2,300 vehicles with current MnDOT STS certificates of compliance, and I believe we came up with that 1.5 additional FTE based on the inspectors that we currently have certified. I don't know that I'd be in the position to say whether that is, you know, in terms of kind of additional work, whether that's light, medium, or heavy. I think that certainly this having an increase in vehicles, you know, of 900, potentially 900 vehicles is definitely something where it's not work that we could absorb based on the staff that we have currently. And so, you know, we would need additional help in the inspection part of our office.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you know, we heard testimony from Ms. Rhodes that that these inspections take 30 to 45 minutes once they, you know, once they arrive. We understand that they have to travel around the state as well. But do you think three inspections a day at 30 to 45 minutes each, is that heavy? Is that light?
Yeah. Are you asking that of me? Yeah. I really would be dependent on others who have much more expertise on what it takes to complete this process than I would be able to speak to. I think it's the inspection time, the articulation of that in writing, the recording of it, the reporting of it. I'm assuming that there's more than simply taking a look at the vehicle, but I would not be able to answer definitively how heavy the load ought to be.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Ms. Rhodes.
That is something, Senator Peterson, that I can also check with our team lead on our enforcement staff and try to get sort of an opinion from him, if that's something you'd be interested in.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Rhodes, do they end up going, they end up spending a night or these overnight trips? Or?
Could be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, the way that my understanding is that we have inspectors sort of spread throughout the state and for the most part strategically placed. And there's a general rule of thumb that I believe it, if you have and I'm not sure on the radius, but, you know, we have a central shop where we do inspections on STS vehicles, limousines. And so depending on the size of your fleet, sometimes the providers come to our shop and sometimes our inspectors go to your place of business where you keep your vehicles. I don't think that they spend overnights. We have within the department, you know, there's quite a bit of paperwork that goes into overnight travel and lodging. So my understanding, and I can confirm this one way or the other, but I don't believe that there's overnight travel involved.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, my last comment, I guess, is just a comment. With an inspection that takes 30 to 45 minutes and obviously having to review a file, I don't think three inspections a day is a heavy load at all, quite frankly. It's very, very light when you look at what the private sector does in terms of inspecting their own vehicles for commercial vehicles, and particularly when you're dealing with a vehicle that is significantly smaller, quite frankly, and is basically a conventional vehicle or a passenger van, as I've heard them described. And I would encourage you to question this fiscal note, because I think your bill would look a lot better if you'd get them to take that those inspection counts. And there's 250 working days in a year, and they're going to do 3,200 inspections with your new bill. That's only three inspections a day, and is a very, very light load in my view.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Senator Dibble,
thank you for that, and we will challenge that. I appreciate any challenges to our fiscal notes, because that could maybe change the overall decal cost. And I also appreciate Senator Westrom's questions. I think that this task force that's dealing with non-emergency medical transportation is continuing to meet. We're going to continue to meet to oversee this process. And, you know, the issue of what impact does having this decal have on a change to the provision of services in the rural area is something that we want to track very closely to determine if that fear or that assumption is, in fact, realized, and if we have to make changes to accommodate to that.
All right. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1292? Okay. Well, after all that, this bill is actually being carried in the Health and Human Services bill, but we had to come back to this division because of the Trunk Highway Fund implications. So with that, we will lay Senate File 1292 on the table. See it again in full finance.
Thank you very much.
Senator Sharon. Right. Members, we have Senator Skoy here who has a smallish bill. We'll see. I don't know.
We'll see.
We can. We're a very thorough committee, though, so we'll see how how small this bill is. Senator Skoy, welcome. Senate File 850.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just standing next to Senator Clausen, and he was wondering how this all happened, but I'm happy to be here. I'm here with Senate File 850, and members, this is a bill that Lake of the Woods County brought to me. They have been contacted by MnDOT regarding a National Weather Service transmitter, and the cell phone reception up on Lake of the Woods is not adequate for the communication that they need. They have some very old equipment, and MnDOT and DNR and Public Safety are hoping that they might have the funds to replace that transmitter. It's $37,000, and I have a handout of the letter if the committee would like to see a copy of the letter.
We'll have a page come up and distribute that.
$36,000.
$36,000, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I'm really kind of amazed at this, not because of a weather transmitter, but that MnDOT would want another $36,000 for it. I mean, this just seems like if MnDOT, who has a very, very large budget, that they couldn't find $36,000 to take care of this weather transmitter. So maybe Senator Skoy or somebody from the Department of Transportation could respond to why they want to do a $36,000 bill.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, I was contacted by the county. I think they feel some obligation to be requesting this money. They're the area that's being serviced by this. I wouldn't know exactly what the internal workings of MnDOT, and I understand DNR is also concerned about this and the Department of Public Safety.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think if they each just threw in $12,000, they could get it done without going through all this committee work. It seems like each one of those three large agencies has huge budgets. So I'm just a little bit puzzled as to, I mean, I can understand Lake of the Woods is a small county, but certainly these three agencies should be able to handle this.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, if the three agencies are willing to do that, I would be fine with that.
Well, maybe we could ask him, Mr. Chairman, to come up to the table and explain to us why they can't spend $12,000.
So would Senator
or $36,000?
Senator Peterson is bounding up to the table with enthusiasm, so, with his checkbook at the ready. Senator Peterson.
Good day. What an easy day this road. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott Peterson from MnDOT.
Mr. Peterson.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Kiffmeyer, the reason I think that this is here is because despite the fact that MnDOT does have a rather large budget, most of our funds are actually dedicated to specific purposes, and actually the amount of general fund that we get is relatively small. And The biggest chunk is, for example, about $16, $17 million we get for Greater Minnesota Transit operating grants. Beyond that, it's relatively small amounts that go into our freight office, our other parts of our transit office, and some other minor parts of our operation, safe routes to school, for example. And so there really isn't, despite our rather large budget bill, in our view, there really isn't $36,000 to fund this. But there is no real MnDOT purpose for this particular for this particular installation.
Well, I'm just puzzled.
Senator
Kipmeyer. Thank you. That MnDOT has contacted both the Department of Natural Resources and DPS, hoping they might have funds to replace the transmitter. So I'm puzzled if you need it, why there can't be an account that you can use to meet this sort of situation, or between the three of you to do that. I just think it's just really quite amazing, and I think I know that there are a lot of really sharp people, and both finance officers and others as well. It seems like you could get this thing done. This is that important in regards to in place for over 20 years. I think it'd be a lot quicker to just put your heads together in your agencies and get this thing done instead of coming here.
Thank you. All right. Anything further, members? Senator Scoia.
Yeah, the only thing I would add, Mr. Chair and members, is that, Lake of the Woods is a big body of water, and they're, having this weather tower is pretty important for the folks that are utilizing the lake. So it'd be nice if we were able to get this accomplished.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I just want you to know, I absolutely don't disagree that you need this. I've fished on Lake of the Woods, great walleye up there, but I don't question that whatsoever. It's that it just seems really almost a bit embarrassing that these three agencies can't come up and take care of it out of their budgets. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. All right. Anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on, what is this, 850? I'm getting my Senate File 850. Nope. With that, we'll lay Senate File 850 on the table for possible inclusion and or possibly
Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Phil. All right. Senator Jensen. Senator Jensen, welcome. Senate File 1768. Senator Jensen, I don't know, we were trying to communicate, send messages down to you. I'm of the understanding there are some fairly complicated technical issues yet to be sorted through.
Oh. I'm sorry, where did you get that from, Mr. Chair?
From counsel. So.
I have an amendment. But.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we see how far we get? We just have a lot of people who have traveled, and we have a long list of things, and so we can't quite get through this in a timely basis. Our thought is maybe to come back on Friday and finish the work if we need to. So we'll
to
try to see what
Friday.
We can get done in about 15 or 20 minutes. There's some technical issues. I'll explain what those are as we. There's just some confusing technical items. Why don't we present the idea and what you're trying to accomplish? We'll work through the amendment, see how far we get. Hopefully we can get done in 15 or 20 minutes.
Okay.
If not, we're going to come back on Friday to finish.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 1768 was heard in judiciary, and what it involves is the idea is that we would provide insurance, health insurance benefits to volunteer firefighters that have died in the line of duty, just as we would currently in law pay for the health insurance of families of career firefighters that have died in the line of duty. What we learned in judiciary is the current statutes that regulate the career volunteer firefighter. We thought we could take that statute and apply it to volunteer, but because career firefighters have group insurance, it created a little difficulty in translating it and using that wording for volunteer firefighters. So what we have done is in an amendment on A3, if we could pass that out and just take a look at it, we made some changes that we talked about in judiciary. The current language, the current one for career firefighters, had language that said, for the period of time that the person is a dependent up to the age of 65, they would get this benefit, which during the conversation we felt was not very clear on who would get the benefit, the dependent or the spouse, and how long they would be able to get the benefit. So the new language in the amendment says for a surviving spouse until the surviving spouse reaches the age of 65, and for each dependent until the dependent reaches the age of 26, they would receive health benefit, health insurance for that amount of time. So that's the first part. And what we did is we corrected it in the current statute and in the new language. So that would apply to career firefighters, and it would apply to volunteer firefighters, as was intended when we thought the bill should move forward. Then there were some questions about, well, what if they don't currently have group insurance, what should that benefit look like? The benefit that we've put in the amendment says that the health insurance coverage would be a comparable to a silver plan under the Affordable Care Act. So that gives some clarity and direction to this municipality or whatever the volunteer fire department is serving under, the ability to understand what should they be providing. Then there is a section that talks about the reporting of firefighter deaths, and that is the same because this is a delete all amendment. And that just requires no matter how they die or whether they're career or volunteer, they just need to report to the fire marshal that the firefighter has indeed died. And that is the amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Senator Jensen. Okay, well, I guess your amendment is pretty good. It clears up some of the questions that were being raised earlier today. Council does have some typo technical amendments to the amendment. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, in reading through it, I just found a couple of little errors that I would hope you could, Senator Jensen, could incorporate in the motion. 1.20 expect should be accept. 1.35, paragraph C should be paragraph B. And then on 2.5, where it says colon 1, I'd like to move that colon 1 a few words down and insert it after who on that same line. So it would say dependent means a person who, colon 1, and then we would have to make a small change then on 2.6, we strike the last word A. On 2.7, strike person and then delete who. So it's clear that dependent means both 1 and 2.
Sorry, say that second one. Person and who?
To strike, get rid of a person who.
Yes. All right. All right. So the A3 would be if Senator Jensen agrees to incorporate those changes. All right.
Mr. Chair.
So expect would be accept, E-X-C-E-P-T. And then C is changed to B on 1.35. And we would move colon 1 to after the word who. On 2.5, and then on 2.7 and 2.6 and 2.7, we would delete a person who.
Correct.
All right. Questions on the amendment, members? All in favor of the A3, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. All right, Senator Jensen.
Okay, I have someone with me here that would just like to talk to the
Mr.
concept
Chair,
again a little bit.
Oh, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Jensen. And this may not really, it certainly does apply to the bill, but I'm just kind of curious as I read line 1-6, for instance, where it talks about a firefighter killed while on duty and discharging the officer's or firefighter's duty, et cetera. To me, that says this all applies if you're if you're actively fighting a fire and you die. But it doesn't seem to apply if you are actively fighting a fire, get involved in that fire, are severely burned, and die 6 weeks later. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sinjum, there is another section of law before this within the statute 299A that includes disability. We're not asking for disability coverage for the volunteer firefighters' families, because we're talking about what we're asking for in this bill is if a volunteer firefighter dies during the line of duty, their family would be granted the same as a career firefighter. Health care benefits to the family would be provided.
But, Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, in my example, if you are a firefighter severely burned, you don't die that day during the fire or anything else, but you do die 6 weeks later from severe burns.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sinjum, all we're asking for is for the family to receive benefits. There are other organizations that take care of the disability of the volunteer firefighter. We're just focusing on that the family would receive health insurance benefits if their spouse dies in the line of duty as a volunteer firefighter. That's what my bill is asking for.
But Mr. Chair, even if they die 6 weeks later, does the family get benefits? I mean, this seems to be a die in the immediate event of the fire to me, the way it's written.
Senator Sinjum, I'll have my testifier respond to that, how it currently works.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ken Prilliman. I'm the Fire Chief and Emergency Management Director for the City of Brooklyn Park. I'll hold my testimony and answer the Senator's question. Amongst the various duties that are assigned to the Commissioner of Public Safety would be her responsibility to investigate the circumstances of that death and make a determination as to whether or not it would qualify under the statute as a line-of-duty death, sir.
Okay. Well,
Mr. Chairman.
And thank you. To me, they are difficult words to apply a death in five, you know, whatever, three, 4 weeks out. But that's not the bill, so it's just a curious question.
All right. Thank you, Senator Sinjum. Appreciate the question. Chief, why don't you proceed with your testimony? Chief Perlman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I represent the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota State Fire Departments Association, along with the Minnesota Chapter of the International Association of Arson Investigators and the Minnesota Fire Marshals. We also have in the audience the president of the Minnesota Fire Department Association, Mark Rosenblum. Members of the committee, 299A 465 covers today approximately 10% of the 20,000 firefighters that protect this great state. 18,000 of those are volunteer, paid on call, or part-time firefighters who, in total, it's estimated save the state $750 million based on the terms of their employment with the communities that they serve. They currently are excluded from this benefit, and at its simplest form, this bill is about equity not intended, but the unintended consequences of the way the current statute reads. We value the life of a part-time firefighter less than we value the life of a full-time firefighter. As the leader and fire chief of the busiest combination fire department in the state of Minnesota, it is almost daily that I have on the same piece of apparatus responding to the same call a full-time and part-time firefighter. And if, God forbid, an accident were to occur and I were to lose both of those, it's my responsibility to explain to the widow that one of them would receive health benefits for their family and the other would not. Now, we understand that the bill has some challenges, and certainly the amendments that were presented accepted today helps that. As one who believes that the first step towards real progress is beginning with the truth is the underlying statute also needs some work. We are committed, all the organizations that I listed are committed to working with the League as well as the Association of Townships to continue to bring forward a correction or modification so that we make this a workable program. But we ask your support in valuing the life of a part-time firefighter at the same basis that we value the life of a full-time firefighter. The families who pay the ultimate sacrifice are entitled to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of the problem that came up is that career firefighters, the way the current process works, is that there's a group health plan already in place and it would just extend to the family. So we're trying to address that and talk about that. And I know the League of Minnesota Cities have been concerned that this is an unfunded mandate. But most of their concern deals with that it's already underfunded for what they currently do, which is not, to me, as reflective in what we're trying to do here. Because we have one firefighter every other year that passes in the line of duty on average in Minnesota with a cost of about $11,000 a year to that family that would be provided to them. So what we're asking for is to allow those volunteer firefighters' families to have that same access to that the career ones do. We're not asking the cities to provide group insurance to all their employees. We're just asking that they figure out and take accountability and try to provide that same benefit to those volunteers. Now in Owatonna, my fire department is a joint. It has career firefighters and it has volunteer firefighters that go to the same fire. And the unforeseen, you know, the terrible tragedy that would happen, that two would die at the same time, one family would get benefits and the other one would not. I think this is wrong and we need to try to fix this. There are some things in statute currently. 471.61 allows a municipality to levy for this type of premium and this cost if it should come up. So there's an avenue there. The township associations already have pools and joint pools that they have access to that they provide other things for. That would be a possibility in this situation as well. Minnesota 101, there are all kinds of things that are available to cities and townships and municipalities that they could figure out how to do it. And I would present to you as members of the Transportation Committee that our communities and townships face unfunded things all the time, and they figure it out, and they figure out how to make that work. And I think this is one, and I hope that you would consider that we make this wrong right, by providing that benefit.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish here. I think the comparable worth of a life, whether you're a career or part-time, matter of fact, for those who are part-time, even more so because they are really stepping away from other jobs that they have as well. But I was just thinking about Senator Senjum's question. I think this had more to do, especially in a firefighting situation, that you might be killed or you die as a direct result of injuries incurred while on duty. And so if you have a severe burn, you may not die that day or in that particular circumstance right there. I think his concern is death as a direct result of those injuries while on duty. I think that was a question, and I wasn't sure either whether this language foresaw, because maybe, like you said, there might be another piece of this chapter that would cover that. Do you know if it also covers if they die as a direct result of injuries incurred while on duty?
Chief.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the bill does not change current process or the role or responsibility of the Commissioner of Public Safety. So this issue exists today. When if a firefighter were to get severely burned and were to live for an extended period of time before passing, the circumstances of that case would be reviewed by the Commissioner and a rendering of a declaration of tying it to the original injury. If at that time the commissioner were to rule it as a line of duty death, then the benefits as outlined in 299A465 would. If for whatever reason the commissioner, using her authority based on the investigation, were to say that there were other circumstances and it was not deemed to be a line of duty death, that death would not be covered the way the bill is currently structured. So we are not attempting to change any of the authority or policies of the commissioner.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Kiffmeyer,
I think that is very helpful, because if you want to keep that parity between them, we don't want to change that by adding language or treating them differently. And I'm
I'm satisfied by your explanation. That's exactly what was needed. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Peterson, I believe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, thank you for your service. And I was on the St. Cloud City Council when we went through an annexation and worked to combine a volunteer and a full-time fire department, and it was not easy. And so I can't imagine what your job must be like. If you're working on that on a regular basis, I want to compliment you on that, because it's a difficult situation. And glad to hear there's some communities that are making that work, because ours could not, and that's unfortunate. And I just want to speak in favor of this bill and make sure Senator Jensen knows that, I'm in support of it and would be happy to work with our caucus on any challenges that may continue to come up. Speaking as a former city council member and representing the city of St. Cloud, I would find it very hard that a resident of that community at that time would not be willing to fund this cost. And I am a little surprised to hear that you're running into some roadblocks there, even from the League of Minnesota Cities, because I would venture to say that I understand their board may know what's going on in regards to this bill, but I would say many of the city council members that pay those dues are probably not following this as closely. And I'll tell you, they would be, there's very few that would not support this, and there's very few residents of the cities that I serve would speak against this. And I want to compliment you on this work and hope that those roadblocks begin to drop off, because I do believe strongly this is something that we need to get done this year and have it. When would your bill go into effect? Yep, right away. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Peterson.
Thank you.
I had a question, Senator Jensen. And because I've talked to you about this bill offline, I know some of the background of it, and I want to thank you for your lengthy work on this. But I did want to clarify something you had said, because I think it bears that clarification. You mentioned that every other year we lose a firefighter. Is that correct?
That's
But that includes both types, all firefighters, right?
That's correct.
So when we talk about the burden to local communities with regard to adding the volunteer firefighter or the part-time volunteer, that's even less than that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to make sure that was clear to everybody else. Additional questions, members, at this point?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sinjum.
Madam Chair, going back to my question, and Senator Kickmeyer followed up on that. And this is your bill, Senator Jensen, and I don't want to muck it up, but I have consulted with counsel on some amendment language, which I think would give me comfort, and I would even think the commissioner would welcome if he or she was ever faced with this issue about a firefighter or a police officer dying subsequent to the event. And if you could just look at your line six, one six, and the amendment would go like this. After duty, I would insert orally, or as a result of injuries sustained during the active, and then change discharging to discharge of. And so it simply says, or as a result of injuries sustained during the active discharge of the officer's duty. I mean, subsequent to the event. And then we would also insert that same language down on line 125, also after duty. And all it attempts to do is, as I said earlier, clarify, at least in my mind, the issue about whether or not a death subsequent to the actual event through injuries is eligible for this initiative which you're taking, which I support 10,000%.
Mm-hmm. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Madam Chair, I would just say, Senator Jensen, you may remember a firefighter in Claremont a couple years ago
mm-hmm.
at the church that you know, was severely injured and so on.
Right. Senator St. John, I have some people that are thinking about what you're saying.
Okay.
Because where you're changing it in Subdivision 2 is the way the current practice works for career firefighters.
Right.
So that would change. This would be no longer just adding volunteers to the system that already has been in place and has been working in that manner. So I'm not opposed to your suggestion, mm-hmm. and I think that situation does come up with career firefighters as well as volunteer, and we would have to include it in both, but can you...
Right, we include it in both.
Yeah, just... Can you repeat again what it is that you're saying?
Sure. So on line 1-6, after duty... the language would go like this, or as a result of injuries sustained during the active, and cross out and they make discharging simply discharge of the officers. Well, I'll just stop it of because that's the last insert.
Ms. Munyon, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I do represent the fire chiefs and the fire department's associations. In speaking with the league, I think they'd be more comfortable if we didn't make that change today. On behalf of the fire service, one concern that adding that language might make a difference is it's unclear to me whether it would prevent the commissioner from calling a heart attack immediately after the fire, part of discharging the duties because of the language that would state injuries. That wouldn't be an injury. So that would be one concern I'd have. I believe that in current practice that when these incidents, these line of duty deaths are reviewed, if there is a death shortly after the event, it is included in the benefits.
Senator Senjum and mm-hmm. Senator Jensen, perhaps, I know we're going to be talking about this moves over after we lay it on the table today for possible inclusion.
Madam Chair, yeah, I agree. Perhaps we've got much business to dwell on this, but just know my thoughts and we can talk and, you know, you might see this amendment on the floor if we can't work it out. Because I do feel strong. I can add as a good senator from St. Cloud pointed out, you know, I can't, and you can't either. If a firefighter happens to die 6 weeks after an event due to burns, for goodness sakes, you know, he or she ought to be accorded the same privileges under this law as somebody that dies right in the event. I think we could all agree on that.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Ms. Munyon.
If the committee were going to make an amendment, then it might be simpler if it just said after on duty or as a result of discharging the officer's duties.
Yes. Madam Chair, let's try to solve it today. We'll just work on it.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Munyon. Ms. Finn, were you going to sorry. Ms. Kushner. Ms. Kushner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Kushner. I am the Human Resources Director for the League of Minnesota Cities. I've testified on this bill in the Judiciary Committee as well, where it was went through without recommendations. We are seeing these amendments for the first time today. We haven't really had time to analyze them. And I am saying, I would like to say that while this bill is perhaps moving in the right direction, there are still significant problems with the language that has been provided. We definitely appreciate the very valuable service that our firefighters provide to cities. It is painful for us to be here testifying against a bill like this, but we have to look at the big picture, and there are still two major problems with this bill. Some of them have been outlined in the letter that we provided to the committee. First and foremost is that this is a state program. It was put into place in 1998, and it has never been fully funded. It has always been funded partially. Cities now pay the bulk of these costs. They didn't ask for this program, and they are now having to find the money to fund it. And I understand that $11,000 a year doesn't sound like very much money, and it probably isn't statewide. However, a couple of things I think need to be taken into consideration. It depends on which community that $11,000 is applied to. Is it a little tiny township? Is it the city of Funkley that has seven people in it? I mean, okay, that's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but we have some very, very small cities in Minnesota that have very, very small budgets, and $11,000 a year over time could mean a lot of money to them. And this is additive over time. It's one firefighter per every other year, but that person could stay, the dependents could stay on the insurance for up to 40 or 45 years. That gets into the hundreds of thousands of dollars for one family. If the firefighter that's killed is 22 years old and his spouse or vice versa, could be 40 years of coverage, okay? And in health insurance does not stay at $11,000 a year. It increases every single year. The average rate is 5 to 10% per year. So you can see that it doesn't go up. That $11,000 isn't going to stay $11,000 for very long. But even if all of those things were fixed, we would still have problems. This is not a one-size-fits-all issue. While our fire chief from Brooklyn Park has a combination department, that's great. We have hundreds of small cities in Minnesota that do not provide group health insurance, and I understand that the amendments provide some possible solutions for that, but the solutions appear to say that you should pay 100% of the premium for the dependents for the volunteer firefighter. That doesn't happen for the career firefighters right now. Right now, if one of his firefighters dies in his city, the city would pay the same contribution that it does for any other active employee. This bill, with the amendments, now says that the volunteer will get 100% dependent coverage. That's a problem. If we want equality, let's have equality. This is actually now treating the volunteer firefighters better than the career firefighters. To us, that makes no sense. I'm sorry, I just don't believe, and our cities don't believe, that this bill is ready for prime time. There are still significant problems with it. They've provided some potential solutions. We appreciate that. We appreciate that they're willing to work with us. That's great, but it's not ready for prime time yet. It needs more work. 299A.465, I've been working with it at the league now for 17 years, and I can tell you I have 90% of the time when a city calls, I have no answer for them because the statute is written so poorly. It has to go be heard by an administrative law judge. It has to be fought in court. There is so little help in that statute for what cities are supposed to do. And most of the cities that are calling me aren't saying, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do this. They're saying, I don't understand what this statute says. What am I supposed to do in this situation? And now we're just going to add another layer of confusion. I'm sorry, we can't support this bill at this point until we have it in a place where our cities know what to do and know where the funding's coming from. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kushner. All right, we're going to move on, and we're going to lay this on the table. Senator Jensen, do you have any concluding remarks?
I would just like to have an opportunity to respond to some of the comments before we leave to come back.
If you can do so briefly, because we do have a lot of testifiers on these other
Absolutely.
Bills from around the state. So thank
Absolutely.
You.
So what I said at the beginning is our attempt to provide this benefit that is provided to career to volunteer. We discovered that the current process, the current language and parts of it, but this has been working for a long time. And when the original bill was produced, it says that state fund was for them to be able to get some reimbursement to help defray a portion of its costs for complying with this section. So the original legislation was never intended to pay the full amount. It says so right in the section. So to come up and say that they have to try to figure out how to get this fully funded would change the entire current process. And that's not what we're asking for in this bill. That's not what we've been looking at. What we've been looking at is take the current process, which League has problems with, but make sure we provide that benefit to the volunteers the same as they serve beside their career volunteer cohorts.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. And with that, we will lay Senate File 1768 as amended.
Madam Chair, can I give my 30-second speech? And I just compliment Senator Jensen on this. You know, I think all of us that serve rural areas in particular know that our volunteer fire departments are key, and it is hard to get volunteers, and it's a real personal commitment on every one of those people's part, and we have to do everything I think we can do reasonably to make sure that these people are kept as happy and secure financially and otherwise as we can if we're going to continue on with a volunteer fire department system in Minnesota. And by the way, I believe if that system ever collapses, it's going to be right in the laps of the state of Minnesota, and that's going to be really expensive. So we need to take care of this.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Senator Westrum.
Find mine.
Two bills.
On the committee.
Interesting.
Madam Chair,
Senator Western,
we will move as swiftly as we can to keep us back on track.
Thank you for your understanding.
Madam Chair, let me ask you, is this bill being, are we moving them or just hearing them, moving them for possible consideration or recommendation, or what, is there a proper motion?
We are hearing them today.
What's that?
We are just hearing them today.
Sure. Okay.
Information. And so are you starting with Senate File 458, the Glenwood Railroad?
Yes, the Glenwood Rail, Senate File 458. Madam Chair, our committee heard about this 2 years ago and appreciate the opportunity to redress the issue. With me is our Pope County engineer and the, one of the local county commissioners who would just have some comment and explanation of this overpass project. Real briefly, Glenwood and Pope County have State Highway 55 and State Highway 29, 55 running mainly east and west, 29 running north and south, north out of Glenwood up to Alexandria. That's the main highway between those two roads, if you're familiar with that area. Just north of Highway 55, feet, not miles, feet, is a very busy railroad track and intersection, and citizens and the commuting public find themselves stopped many times a day at this intersection because of rail cars coming through. That has only gotten more intense in the last few years with all the oil and grain shipments, but oil really filling up our rail lines, and a safety issue that has been around for a long time but exacerbated with the rail car traffic. And they have a rail yard in the north side of Glenwood as well, just to the east of this intersection as well, which is also another heavily used and a place where the rail cars come and go. And so while the rail cars are good for industry and traffic, we are pursuing trying to have a more usable intersection for both rail and the commuting public and the citizens and the safety issues that go along with it. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Brian Gies, the Pope County engineer, and he can explain it briefly, and then Mr. Wagner, and then for some questions. So you do have a map in your packets, I believe.
Yes. Mr. Gies, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Brian Gies. I'm the Pope County engineer and representing Pope County. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 458. $10 million bond appropriation for the construction of an interchange and grade separation on Trunk Highway 29 with Trunk Highway 55 and the Canadian Pacific Railroad. This project is tremendously important for the safety of the residents and the travelers in the Glenwood region. It also have a dramatic impact on the economic vitality of Trunk Highway 29 corridor. Last year, at the end of the year, December 31st, the Commissioner of Transportation issued a study on grade crossings and rail safety for the transport of oil and other hazardous materials. In the study, this project is included as a top 10 priority across the state of Minnesota for construction of a grade separation between Trunk Highway 9 and the Canadian Pacific Railway. Other work that's been concluded is the MnDOT District 4, Jody Martinson, the district engineer, and her staff have came up with a conceptual plan for this project and a corresponding estimate for this project. In 2012, when it was last heard, the estimate was just under $10 million for construction and a little over $12 million in total, including the other project development costs. Without this project funding, it will not be possible within the existing funds. As all of you know, there's a big demand for maintaining and preserving the existing infrastructure. It's difficult with traditional sources to find money for an expansion or improvement project such as this. As Senator Westrum noted, you've got a picture of this in the area. And as also he stated, one of the issues with the interchange and intersection with the railroad is that when trains are traveling from west to east, they're required to make that relatively sharp turn towards the southeast and then enter or cross through the rail yard. This requires trains to move quite slowly through the area and oftentimes stop for a switch in the rail. And it results in significant delays for transportation movements on Trunk Highway 29. It often impacts the traffic on 55 as well as it's backed up through the intersection. As the number of trains and the length of these trains continue to increase, these incidents are becoming more and more a concern. So there are three major issues directly related to the current intersection design and the inability to cross the tracks at this intersection. We believe this construction project can effectively mitigate all of these concerns. The first and primary concern of the region is adequate emergency response. Because of the nature of the way Glenwood's rolled out and the rural nature of the intersection, the local hospital and ambulance service that extends beyond this intersection have a very difficult time responding to emergencies to the north. One of their major concerns is getting across this intersection whenever they're dispatched to the north. Anecdotally, I'd add that my office window actually faces this intersection. I personally witness several backups and delays every day. In fact, a recent expo went on in the city of Glenwood by the Chamber of Commerce, and a conductor for the railroad commented that his train recently had blocked the intersection for 55 minutes. A second concern is the impediment to safe and efficient routine traffic flow. Although it's not apparent on an aerial photo, the intersection here is in a low area. It's in a depressed area of Trunk Highway 29, and so as the traffic gets backed up, stopped, either for the rail or for other reasons, it creates a risk for rear-end collisions, which is one of the more common crashes in the area. There was also recently a large expansion of a propane distribution center on Highway 55 to the east, so a lot of propane trucks come through this intersection. As you're probably aware, propane trucks, along with other hazardous material haulers, have to stop at the tracks, and because of the relative distance between Trunk Highway 55 and the railway, they pull off to the side, they stop at the tracks, and they have to cross two lines of traffic in order to make a quick left turn, also creating a safety hazard for rear-end collisions of hazardous materials. The third and final primary concern is economic development of the region. The economic development to the community to the north on Trunk Highway 29 is reaching to the south out of Alexandria. Our economic growth in the Glenwood area is reaching north on the 29 corridor, and the existing condition here is coming up with a detriment to economic development in our region because of concerns of the delays and hazardous of this intersection. So in closing, Although neither of these highways are involved in the county's jurisdiction, this remains a top priority for Polk County. We thank Senator Westrum for offering this bill and the committee for its consideration. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gies. And Mr. Wagner, we have about 3 minutes left. Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you. My name is Gordy Wagner. I'm a Polk County Commissioner, currently serving my second term. I'm also a former Glenwood City Commissioner, and last fall I ran unsuccessfully for the State House in District 12B, where this overpass would be located. I'll just make my comments very brief. Brian mentioned that Senex had made Glenwood a distribution center now for LP gas. After the shortage of the winter of 2013-14, last year they added 90,000 gallon tanks. They bring the product in on rail, and during the season when they haul it out, they average between 20 and 30 trucks a day, a half a mile from this intersection. The DOT maintenance supervisor in Alexandria, who oversees the Alexandria shop and the Glenwood shop, Alexandria is 15 miles north of Glenwood, 50 miles north of this intersection. He tells me that this stretch of highway, 29 between Glenwood and Alexandria, is the second busiest highway that his crews maintain. It is follows I-94, which goes east and west, just south of Alexandria. I believe in putting public safety at the top of my priorities when I make decisions on the county board, and I hope this committee also does. This is a much more curable problem to me than some of these cities that have trains going through them, splitting their business sections or through their residential areas. This is outside residential, but I feel very strongly this is an accident waiting to happen, and an overpass is very doable in this intersection, and it would cure today's problems and those in the future. Thank you. And I thank Senator Westrum for carrying this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Senator Westrum, closing comments?
You know, Madam Chair, if there's any questions, we're happy to answer them. Hope that gave you a flavor of the intersection and a remedy to solve this intersection that's continued to see growing traffic. I leave you with one comment, and I know I've met with Gordy and others in the county. Literally, there are examples where there's accidents just north of the tracks. There's trains on the tracks, and the ambulances have to go either to the east or the west several miles to find another intersection on a gravel road to get around to that side. I've even heard a story recently, not very long ago, a year or two ago, where some rescue folks actually literally started crawling through this stalled train on the tracks to get to the other side where the accident was at. And so that's the type of issue we're trying to deal with this railroad crossing north of Glenwood. Happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Wagner and Mr. Gies, for coming and for sharing this story. Significant. All right, so Senate File 710. Senator Westrum, if your other testifiers would like to approach.
I got another one, yeah.
And Senator Westrum, the packet with the information and the map of this one has been distributed. So.
Very good. On the 710, I believe it is,
yes.
Madam Chair. Senate File 710. I'll get started. And Madam Chair, committee, appreciate your consideration of this bill. It's dealing with a county bridge infrastructure in the city of Melrose, and joining us is the Stearns County engineer, as well as a local city, the Melrose City Mayor, who will tell you a little more about this issue. But again, a bridge that would be a cost of about $2.4 million. It is deficient. And there are restrictions on this bridge now. The main connection between the school and the city is through this bridge over the Sauk River, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. Over the Sauk River, just on the north side of Melrose, a very heavily traveled and busy bridge. And I'll let the county engineer introduce herself and inform you about the deficiencies that they are facing and the need to assist with improving this infrastructure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jody Tyke. I'm the Stearns County engineer. Thank you for the opportunity to allow the city of Melrose and Stearns County to testify in support of Senate File 710. In rural Stearns County, some of our most important farm-to-market routes provide either one of our many river crossings or a connection to Interstate 94. This particular section of County State Aid Highway 13 does both. Unfortunately, this bridge over the Sauk River is deteriorating and can no longer fully serve all the traffic that does need to use it. The in-place bridge is narrow, cannot accommodate any permitted overweight loads, and the pedestrian accommodations are unsafe at best. Considering the bridge serves farm-to-market traffic in the northern portion of Stearns County and is the connection between Melrose schools and a large portion of the city of Melrose, this concerns, obviously, both the county and the city of Melrose. Our proposed project will not only replace the deficient bridge, it also addresses several safety concerns in the immediate area so that traffic won't need to be disrupted again at some point in the future. This particular bridge has been on the local deficient bridge waiting list since before the 2014 legislative session when some money was allocated to local bridges. This bridge remains unfunded. In order for Stearns County to replace this bridge without some infusion of outside funding, we will need to delay several projects that are also badly needed in rural Stearns County and have likely already been delayed multiple years. Even though the county has implemented several other methods of funding these projects, we are still struggling to keep up with the necessary improvements to our road system that serves our farm-to-market traffic. Further delaying improvements to other farm-to-market routes within the county to accomplish this one is, for obvious reasons, not desirable. This county road crossing of the Sauk River is a vital link for the Melrose area and is an important farm-to-market route for western Stearns County. It provides a direct connection between Melrose and Interstate 94 corridor to northern Stearns County. Any further restrictions on the bridge, I'm concerned, will drive traffic to local city and township roads that are not built to carry county road traffic. This bridge certainly can't be ignored. In closing, I'd like to thank Senator Westrum and this committee for consideration of this bill that would fund our project.
Thank you, Ms. Tyke. Are you Mayor Finken?
Yes.
Welcome to the
Chair,
committee.
As close as you can.
Thank you so much for having me here. I appreciate it. County Road 13 Bridge, Joe Finken, Mayor for the City of Melrose.
Excuse me.
County Road 13 Bridge impact. To put it in perspective from the City of Melrose point of view, the cost participation and total cost for this project equals more than 50% of our annual $2.3 million general fund budget. The city share of this project is bore 100% on the shoulders of our residents, even though we feel it is a regional project. 100% of this funding comes out of the emergency set-aside funds and operating revenues, reserves. To break it down even further, that is $959 per family. This is a major burden to our community. This project cannot be delayed, postponed, or retrofitted. Because of this project, our entire set-aside fund for road improvement will be in a deficit by over $800,000 by the year 2019. We cannot operate in a budget deficit, so this means postponing more projects. We need your help. The 1,147 homes in our city need your help, and we need the help of the state of Minnesota's bonding bill. Here's the top 10 reasons I recommend that you support this project. The regional significant. It will be shovel ready by the third quarter of 2015. It is a rural project. The bridge and its intersection is the main intersection between the city of Melrose and northern Stearns County. It has 30% higher traffic count than the nearest bridge. The bridge is considered functionally obsolete. Bridge requires annual inspection. The sidewalk on the bridge is not ADA compliant and does not meet the DNR standard for trail sidewalks. Would greatly improve the access to our Sauk River Park, which is considered a regionally significant park. The city of Melrose has never received bonding dollars before. Well, I'll say it like this. The last time an elected official from Melrose has been here was early 1970s. At that time, the Melrose Dutchman boys basketball team won the state title. And that was before my time. Now, roughly 41 years later, our Melrose Dutchman basketball team has won the state title again. So, it's been a long time. So, the city of Melrose now would like to see us with a win for the Melrose area. Senator Kiffmeyer talked about fiscal responsibility. We have always been a city to do our projects on our own. To live in our town, we live within our means. And now we're asking for your help and your support. So I, Joe Finken, as mayor of the city of Melrose and a volunteer firefighter, I know you want to keep firefighters happy. This is truly a regional project, and the bonding focuses on bridges and roads. This should be added to the list of projects. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mayor, and I'm pretty sure you just got Senator Senjum's vote. So, are there any additional testifiers, Senator Westrup?
No, Madam Chair, that concludes our presentation. Happy to take any questions if there is, and certainly we appreciate the time to demonstrate and discuss this issue in Melrose and Stearns County.
Thank you, Senator Westrum. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Senator Westrum, and to the mayor and Stearns County engineer, this is our third day of hearing projects that are very worthy projects, without question. Though we do not earmark in this committee, the process has always been for decades that we fund a bridge account or roads or something like that, and then it is up to MnDOT themselves in whichever ones of these sources of funding. And my question was to ask you if you are on that list of bridges, and it sounds like you are.
Yes, we are.
Do you have any indication? Many times people are on that list and they have larger bridges, smaller bridges. Sometimes we have an emergency like Stearns County did when they had a bridge that was severely deficient, and it was immediately at a very, very large expense put on the list at the very top and just put in there because of the urgent need for Stearns County. I believe it was the 23 one that connects Highway 10 to the downtown city of St. Cloud. So sometimes when that happens, it bumps other projects down the list. But recognizing that severe deficiencies can happen and that circumstances are such that they will get bumped up the list, which often means, because there's a limited pool of dollars, others get down. And so Stearns County itself had a direct benefit in that regard of being bumped up because of a serious need, but it might have also correspondingly affected your bridge project. But I would hope that there aren't many of those very large bridge projects like the one that crossed the Mississippi River connecting was a very large project. There aren't many of those, but in the bridge account they usually manage small and large. But do you have any indication of kind of, are you towards the top of the list at this time?
Ms. Tyke, do you have that information?
Madam Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I don't know where we fall on the list. I know that when the last legislation that allocated money to local bridges was adopted, we had three bridges on the waiting list, and there was only sufficient funding for Stearns County to get one of its bridges replaced. It's currently under construction right now, but we have this bridge and another bridge on that waiting list because they're ready to go, and we have several other deficient bridges not on that list because we haven't begun the plans yet. So I can't answer where we are on the list, but I do know the last legislation only allowed us to replace one of our bridges.
Madam Chair,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
When you say only allowed you to replace for Stearns County,
there are many
others statewide that were able to be done.
Correct.
And they do try and spread it around because there's 86 other counties, so they do try and assess that. And MnDOT has a process by which they do review these, and I know that The more that we put into the bridge account, though, of course, the more bridges they can actually do. And but Senator Carlson and I were just discussing the fact that as we have heard these different kinds of bridge bills over the years, that we want to be realistic in our expectations of any particular one project as far as the process that it goes through, and that we don't earmark, but that the bridge account itself has a process by which they assess and put the neediest at the top, and you work your way through. So I just wanted to be sure, Madam Chair, that we just had kind of a clear understanding and don't have false expectations of what this committee can do.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Carlson, did you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I wanted to reiterate what Senator Kiffmeyer said and maybe add just a little bit more to it. We have been hearing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of road projects. And if you look at the language in the bills, they often do say come from the Trunk Highway Fund, which is a fund that we do not earmark. That is up to the people who do the work to do the prioritization and to do the spending. And that said, that at this point, there is not, let's say, universal appetite for putting more money into the Trunk Highway Fund so that we can afford to bond for any projects. I believe the MnDOT will tell you that we have, for all practical purposes, reached the top of the bonding capacity of that fund. So it's very important for people when they leave this room after giving their presentation on what I think are very worthy projects, that there's a high likelihood that unless something happens, they're not going to happen. And it's extremely important that we all recognize that. And I'm very happy that we're having these conversations, because what it does do is it does point out and put back up to the need that we have. And we're defining the need. And I think everyone now recognizes that the need is huge. It is large. And all of these stories and requests are very important to us. And they will be all considered in what we're going to do with the funds available.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. And Senator Kiffmeyer, if we can be brief, because we have people who need to catch a plane. So thank you.
Oh, wow. Catch a plane. All right. That is finite. I understand that. I just wanted to say that I think there is an appetite. How that gets funded is a question, but there is an appetite to see additional funds go there. So I just wanted to be clear.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. All right. Senator Westrum, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Appreciate the dialogue and interest. So.
Thank you very much. And next up, we'll have Senator Claussen, Senate File 292. Senator, if you and your testifiers can come to the table, please. Senator Claussen, whenever you're ready, please proceed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to meet with you and present Senate File 292. We currently have a safety issue at the interchange of County Road 42 and Highway 52 in Dakota County. And to rectify this situation, Senate File 292 requests $10 million from the Bond Proceeds Fund for Stage 1 of a project which provides for the expansion of County Road 42 to a four-lane roadway and the addition of turn lanes at the interchange. The Highway 52 bridge will be made longer to allow for a widening of County Road 42 and will be designed to accommodate the future full interchange project, which is on schedule for future development. The project is expected to improve safety and add capacity to the interchange for future traffic growth. Madam Chair, I would like to turn your attention to a packet of materials that you have. The first page is a bar graph, but I would like you first, if you would change to turn to the third page. And I think this gives you a good representation of the situation we're talking about.
What you see moving from right to left is Highway 52. It's the main north-south highway route from Minneapolis-St. Paul to Rochester, and daily about 32,500 vehicles travel on this route. Going from top to bottom on that page is County Road 42, and you are looking at the top to the west and to the bottom is to the east. And County Road 42 is the main east-west route in the area from western Dakota County to Hastings. And we average about 20,600 vehicles per day traveling through the County Road 42, Highway 52 interchange between Rosemont and Hastings. As you can see, there are exit and entrance ramps to Highway 52 at this intersection in both the north and south directions. In addition, County Road 42 narrows from four lanes west of Highway 52, the bridge, to two lanes of traffic east of Highway 52 bridge. And I think you can see that in the diagram that you have. And this is presenting some difficulty. If you now would turn to the first page, that bar graph, that front page of the packet provides the crash and severity rates for the interchange. Crash rates are defined as accidents reported by the local police or highway patrol, and severity rate measures accidents resulting in personal injury and or fatality. The crash and severity rates are well above state averages at the interchange, with the northbound interchange ramp the most dangerous. And we did have a fatal accident occurring in 2007 at that interchange. Just turning back to that diagram on page 3, give you a little bit more information about the traffic patterns in that area. The University of Minnesota Umore property is less than 1 mile from the interchange. It's in the upper left-hand corner. This past year, gravel mining at the Umore property increased traffic in the area by adding over 200 heavy trucks daily entering and exiting County Road 42. And several of those trucks travel through the Highway 52 County Road 42 interchange. And again, the Umore property one time was a World War II arms plant. The Flint Hills refinery is a mile north of the intersection. That would be to the right on the diagram that you are looking at. And that contributes to heavy traffic patterns in the area as well. The facility is expanding, over 2,000 construction workers entering the refinery daily, in addition to the regular 1,000 member workforce. Many traveling through the Highway 52-42 interchange. We also have Wayne Transport as a large terminal adjacent to the intersection. That would be on the lower right-hand section, although the building that you see is not Wayne Transport. It's another industry that's there. Wayne Transport specializes in tanker trucks, hauling, and is a major transporter of petroleum products, accessing the Flint Hills refinery, operating between 145 and 180 trucks daily. Bay and Bay Transportation also has a terminal adjacent to the intersection with a fleet of over 400 trucks that enter and exit weekly at that area. We also have C&F Industries, which is an international fertilizer manufacturer and distributor. There are 20,000 trucks per year that enter that facility, which is only a mile or mile and a half away from that intersection. And then we have SKB Environmental. It's within a mile of the intersection. SKB is a major innovative solid waste management and recycling facility in the metropolitan area. Over 1,700 trucks per week enter the facility, averaging 300 trucks per day. And they are also expanding their footprint in the area, resulting in addition truck traffic. We have two testifiers, Rosemont Mayor Bill Drosty. He's also provided a letter that's in your packet. He'll be providing testimony. And Mr. Steve Melke, Dakota County Physical Development Division Director.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
And we have about 6 minutes left, time check. So, I can't do math. So is Mr. Melke going first?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, my name is Steve Melke. I'm the Director of Physical Development Division for Dakota County. And I'm here today on behalf of the Dakota County Board of Commissioners to support Senate File 292 and for $10 million in state bonding. for the first stage of a project to reconstruct the intersection of Trunk Highway 52 and County Highway 42 in Dakota County. This project has been developed in cooperation with the Department of Transportation, the City of Rosemount, and is a priority project for the Highway 52 Freeway Partnership, which is composed of three counties, Dakota, Goodhue, and Olmsted. And hopefully you've received a copy of their latest piece on the 52 partnership. The involvement of these partners demonstrates that this is a project of statewide and regional significance. Highway 52 is a high-priority interregional corridor connecting Rochester to the Twin Cities, carrying almost 35,000 trips per day at this location, of which 12% is heavy commercial truck traffic. County Road 42 is the only east-west principal arterial, which is the only route south of I-494 in Dakota County, carries 12,000 trips per day west of the interchange. Despite County Highway 42 being under county jurisdiction, the interchange is an important connection between two principal arterial routes in the statewide transportation system. It is safety at the ramp intersections that drive the need for this project. The existing 52 bridges are very short, resulting in County 42 narrowing from four lanes to two, with limited visibility for traffic at the intersection and no room for turn lanes. These factors have led to a number of injury and fatal crashes over the past several years, with both crash and severity rates at the ramp intersections that are more than double the comparable statewide rates. Further, it's projected the population of Rosemount will more than double by 2030, meaning demands on this intersection will only increase. This project would replace the existing Trunk Highway 52 bridges to allow for reconstruction and widening of Highway 42 underneath to a four-lane divided section with turn lanes at ramp intersections. This work will improve the lane continuity and sight distance issues and increase safety and reduce crashes at the interchange, improve mobility, and facilitate development in the area around the project. With the requested bond funding, the local cost share will be $2.5 million, or a 20% match, for a total projected estimated construction cost of $12,500. We are currently working on the design of the project, and we hope to break construction in 2017. This is a cost-effective project that supports the long-term needs of the location. We've worked with MnDOT and the City of Rosemount to plan for the growth in this area. The first stage is the bridge and highway work, and will be designed and constructed in a manner to allow for use as part of the future full system interchange that will include high-speed ramps, loops, and frontage roads. The need for the future interchange work will be driven by increased traffic associated with the planned growth in Rosemount and the surrounding area. I thank you for your consideration of this bill and for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Mielke. And Mayor Droste, if I can ask you to try to dream ahead to about 2 minutes, that'd be great. Thank you.
I'll make it even shorter. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I want to say thank you, Senator Claussen, for authoring this. I've been mayor since 2003, and one of the first meetings I attended was in Zambroda on the 52 corridor. And the partners at that time were talking about the Rochester end, which took, I think it was 4 years. So subsequently, you can see I have not been very successful over the last 12 years. But the importance, regional importance, especially when you look at the refinery, the CF industries, the heavy industry, it does have regional significance. So with that, I want to say again, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. And just a reminder that the Senate Transportation Committee did take a visit down into southern Minnesota, and we came back up 52 and saw a lot of that corridor and those and that process. So we were glad to have the opportunity to see that firsthand. So I remember passing over that intersection because I've heard this story before. Thank you, Senator Claussen and testifiers. Members, any other questions? Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to add my support for this project. Dakota County doesn't ask for much, but we've been asking for this particular project for a long, long time. And in fact, the package of photographs that you have, the very first photograph has the four quadrants on it. It's looking north. It's this particular one. And interestingly, former House member Representative Dennis Osmond is his home. Was, and I think he's moved now, but his home was there, and he was on a bill to help this get passed years ago. So it has been waiting, and I grew up not too far away from there, and I can vouch that there's been a lot of lives lost on that intersection. And it has been because of, particularly, there was a railroad bridge there with a median on it at one time, and I think there were a lot of accidents because of that. And then this narrowing, the concept of going from four lanes to two, really was a failure there, because it causes a lot of confusion, both for people that are coming on to 42 from 52 and also the people that are attempting to pass through that underpass. So I'm hoping that we will be able to find a place for this.
Another very worthy project. Thank you, Senator Claussen, and to your testifiers for being here and sharing this with us, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, Senator Metzen has been patiently waiting with Senate File 852. Senator Metzen.
Good to be here. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 852 has to do with a project in West St. Paul, Minnesota. It's a Robert Street street improvement, sewer improvement, everything else you can think of. This street has not been upgraded for over 30 years, and it's a major construction project. It's about $32 million. We'd like to have the state, it's a state highway, and quite frankly, it runs from just out front of the Capitol here, Robert Street, Highway 3, to all the way to Northfield, Minnesota. So it's a very significant area that it goes through, and it's, I guess we got a man of white is here on the display. And we have the city, I'm going to have these folks introduce themselves, but in the meantime, MnDOT pavement ratings classify Robert Street at the bottom 8% of the state roads, and that's the bad side, the bad 8%. 25,000 vehicles a day go through this area, and at one time, I'm not sure if it's true now, but it was the highest traffic two-lane highway in the state of Minnesota. So we're asking for today kind of the state to be more of an equal partner on this. It is a state highway, and at first we thought we needed about $8 or $9 million, but I think we've pared that down a little bit to about $4.2 million. And again, it's very regional significance, significant, and we just want better partnership with the state. So I did you get that handout?
Yes. We do have the packet.
Okay. How come you guys get colored ones? Did I get black and white? Oh, my gosh. But anyway, that's what we're here for. I have a couple of city council members here that like to give a few remarks, if that's all right.
Great. Absolutely. Thank you. Whichever of your testifiers would like to go first.
Thank you. Dave Napier from the city council, West St. Paul. Honorable Chair and committee members, thank you for having us here today. We're looking at the Roberts.
Stop everything. Yeah. I got a colored one.
You got a colored one. Right.
There you go. All is right with the world.
Okay, I felt slighted.
Mr. Napier.
The Robert Street Improvement Project is why we're here today. The undertaking involves the reconstruction of State Trunk Highway 952A, which extends through our community of West St. Paul. You have been given the PowerPoint, but in the sake of time and respect to your time, we have we'll just allow you to review that at your when you have an opportunity, rather than go through it today. Robert Street is only a 2.5 mile piece of a much larger regional state highway corridor that extends as far south as Faribault. The state highway carries upward of 25,000 to 30,000 vehicles every day, and feeds north into the city of West St. Paul. Clearly, Robert Street is a vital piece of the overall State Trunk Highway transportation system. Robert Street is also a very important local road for the city of West St. Paul. The corridor stretches through the center of our community and is the heart of our commercial district. Robert Street defines West St. Paul, and as a result, as the corridor is successful,
Is he here?
That success is paralleled in the vitality of our community. As a fully developed city, West St. Paul's future is dependent on being able to attract new business investment and new families to the places and spaces that exist today. The commercial businesses on Robert Street currently generate about $19 million in annual state sales tax revenue, making it also a very important commercial area for the state of Minnesota. I must say that as a lifelong member of the community and now as elected official representing the interests of the constituents in West St. Paul, the current condition of the State Trunk Highway 952A extending through West St. Paul has and continues to seriously inhibit our community's future and our ability to continue to capture the state sales tax revenue because of the deteriorating roadway. I would like to share a little story, a personal story, about my father-in-law who lives in a senior building in West St. Paul. About 4 weeks ago, we had to call 911, unfortunately, with a pretty serious medical condition. The health east showed up with their ambulance and decided they have to transport him to what we thought was Regents Hospital. We went down there. My sister-in-law decided to ride with her father in the ambulance, and we decided to pile in the car and meet them at the hospital. We got to the hospital. We waited 10 minutes. We thought we were in the wrong hospital, so we kept texting my sister-in-law, who was in the ambulance. And about 12 minutes after we left the place, they arrived at the ambulance entrance to the hospital. We found out later that they will not use Robert Street as a way to a hospital. And it is solely because of the condition of the road. Now, I don't say that because my father-in-law's health was in risk. I say it because how many other people avoid using Robert Street? And so we're here to address that. And I will at this time pass it on to my colleague to say a few words.
Thank you.
Ms. Halverson, one of our city council members.
Welcome, Ms. Halverson.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and committee members. Thank you also for the opportunity for me to speak today. As my colleague alluded to earlier, there also exist issues beyond safety. We must also examine the economic impacts of the current road conditions. The structural deficiencies and overriding safety concerns have erected an onerous barrier to business investment. We've seen numerous businesses try, fail, and leave West St. Paul due to the unacceptable state of State Trunk Highway 952A. And as young families and home seekers of every demographic seek new places to call home, they look at West St. Paul the way probably most of you do. When you mention West St. Paul, everyone almost always answers, "Oh, yeah, I know, Robert Street." That's immediately what comes to mind. Right now, that's unfortunate because that road does not reflect our residents and our vibrant, diverse, and welcoming community. Those defining West St. Paul by the perception they develop while driving down our most important piece of road are electing to invest somewhere else. They're investing somewhere where they feel they'll get a better return, someplace that's supported by its own residents as well as the state, and someplace where they can invest their dollars in their own families and in their own communities instead of investing in vehicle realignments. This is a pivotal moment in West St. Paul's history. Our community's future is dependent upon creating an environment where people choose to invest. As the economy continues to improve and the metro area continues to grow and thrive, West St. Paul needs to be a community of choice. We cannot afford to wait, and State Trunk Highway 952A in West St. Paul needs to be constructed now, reconstructed now. As we have engaged our own community over the past decade, this project has easily emerged as a top priority for our residents. The challenge has always became how to pull together the necessary partners to accomplish this very expensive and very complex reconstruction project, combing through what's a tangle of a local road, a bustling business district, and a state highway. Over the past 4 years, West St. Paul has spearheaded the effort to comprehensively address this paramount issue and complete the necessary work. We've worked closely with MnDOT, the federal government, and Dakota County in planning the needed reconstruction elements. And we'd like to take this opportunity to say that West St. Paul is profoundly grateful for the partnership and the work that MnDOT has provided throughout this process. And after tying it all together,
the street reconstruction project is estimated to cost over $32 million. Our financing for this includes funding for MnDOT, but the state's contribution represents only 17% of the overall cost. The City of West St. Paul's contribution is nearly half of the entire project cost. Local West St. Paul taxpayers, who are largely older residents living on fixed incomes, are paying a grossly and disproportionately high portion of this state highway project. If additional funding, or in addition to that burden, $4.1 million of this local contribution still needs a funding source. If additional funding is not located, other critical improvements like local road reconstruction projects, addressing pressing and overdue public safety facility needs, and utility improvements will be deferred for at least several years. And as I testify here this afternoon, the reconstruction of this section of the State Trunk Highway is getting underway, and it will be completed over the course of the next 2 years. The City Council made the decision to get this project underway regardless of lingering questions and needs remaining relating to the overall funding for several reasons. One, the deplorable and unsafe road conditions could not be tolerated any further. Two, the construction costs and consequently the resulting tax impacts would continue to grow as more time passed. Our residents and regional community expect that action will be taken. And we needed to explore every opportunity we had to responsibly trim costs as more and more appeared to be falling on the backs of our residents. And most importantly here is that the city received an $8 million federal grant a number of years ago, and that grant required that this money be spent by May of 2015. So if we were to not start this project now, we would lose $8 million in federal grant proceeds. So I'll wrap this up quickly, and given what we have spoken about here today and considering the additional details in your packets, our request is that the state increase their contribution to this project. Given that it is a state highway, it should logically follow that the state would have a higher financial commitment toward this project than the city. Our request would place the state's commitment at 42% of the project costs and the city's portion at 23%. We certainly acknowledge, and we've heard much testimony here today alone, that there's difficult work in front of this committee and in front of the legislature in addressing and resolving the hefty and significant infrastructure and transportation needs around the state. We respectfully request your help in addressing our unique situation with the current and real financing deficiencies on this state trunk highway project that is now falling squarely on the local taxpayers in West St. Paul. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator Metzen, and your testimony.
Madam Chair, she's absolutely
and
correct.
Very briefly, if we can, because we are now a little over time. So.
Okay. City is at about 48% the contribution on the state highway, and we just like a little boost there. And like Ms. Halverson mentioned, about 22 to 24% of our population from the first-ring suburb as a senior citizens in West St. Paul. So it puts a real hardship on every homeowner, the taxpayer, but particularly on that senior-aged population in our community. So appreciate your listening, and we need your help.
Thank you, Senator. And I will point out to members that in the PowerPoint there is several good helpful breakdowns of the costs and the stakeholders' contributions to it. So thank you for providing great information.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, next we will move on to Senator Nenow with Senate File 1402.
This was probably the most difficult handout to read. What does that mean? It's one on
it just said. Welcome, Senator Nenow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to let my guests do most of the talking. My vocal capabilities are a bit diminished today. Senate File 1402, briefly, would allocate $1.8 million as a grant to the City of Cambridge to widen about a mile and a half stretch of State Highway 95. This stretch runs right through the heart of downtown, out to the edge of the city where there is significant long-term care facilities and Anoka Ramsey Community College, Cambridge campus, which generates a lot of traffic in and of itself. But with that, I will let the representatives from the city tell you more.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Iverson. I'm on city council for the city of Cambridge. And please excuse my shakes. I would like to point out a couple things in the summary that you guys received. There's a bullet point that says the city has spent about $35 million over the last 15 years in improving alternate transportation routes. We have had many efforts done by the city to identify improvement opportunities, including reprogramming the MnDOT traffic signal system and conducting a comprehensive corridor study with many entities involved. Widening Highway 95 to four lanes is the best option. Out of the four options that we were given, it's also the least expensive option. We have a primary and secondary school on 95 in Delwood. This is widening the highway would be very beneficial to the safety of that elementary school. The city is improving Cypress and Fern to facilitate traffic flow. We need the 95 improvements to expand that safety aspect. Highway 95 improvements have been scheduled but then delayed and have not included widening to meet the current and future needs. A four-lane road would cost approximately $6 million more than two lanes. This project is still not on MnDOT's improvement program. MnDOT agrees with the recommendation to widen Highway 95, but there's not adequate funding to do so now. If you look, there's a letter on page 5 from Dave Schwarting to the mayor of Cambridge. He's from the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and in the second paragraph, MnDOT agrees with the recommendation to widen Highway 95. Any questions?
If we can go through the testifiers, and then if there are any questions, we'll come back to those. Thank you. Welcome to the
greetings,
committee.
Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Linda Wolf, and I'm the City Administrator for the City of Cambridge. And I'd just like to draw a little picture for you about what the City of Cambridge is like. We are population 8,222, according to the latest state demographer's estimate. However, we provide 67% of the employment opportunities in Isani County. And we regionally are designated by the Department of Revenue as a sub-regional trade center, and we serve a population of approximately 40,000 people. Highway 95 is the state's main trunk highway corridor for the east-west corridor of the entire state. The $1.8 million that we're asking for would allow us to do the preliminary engineering. It would allow us to purchase some right-of-way that is going to become available in 2015, and it allows us to get some environmental work done out of the way. Now you're asking, why would a city want to do that kind of work on a state trunk highway? Quite frankly, we've asked MnDOT to include this in their 30-year transportation plan for over 15 years already. In 2008, we did the corridor study. MnDOT agrees with it, but the answer we keep getting from MnDOT each and every year is there's only room for funds for preservation. No room for expansion. We are literally afraid that if they do their repavement project, that that's going to condemn our community to a two-lane road for the next 30 years, which would be unfortunate. Currently, this two-lane section carries 12 to 15,000 vehicles per day. We have numerous trains. We average 20 trains per day. Each train that comes through, we have an average closing time of 10 minutes. Our longest closing was 67 minutes, which backed up traffic 9 miles, which is halfway to Princeton. Again, 95 is the major east-west corridor. It's stifling our manufacturers' ability to get their products out to market because all of our industrial parks rely on Highway 95. It is stifling our economic development and redevelopment because people simply do not want to deal with the congestion in our community, very similar to what you've just heard from West St. Paul and Robert Street. We're just asking you to be a partner with us to help solve the issue of State Trunk Highway 95 through the City of Cambridge and allow us to be an economically viable community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Senator Nina?
Madam Chair, I'll just add on to that. It was briefly alluded to, but I want to make it very clear that the request is coming at this time not just because the city wants it, but because it's very, very timely. There is a significant portion of land that is going to be immediately abuts the highway. It's a long-term care facility. They are going to take that down and then across the bridge and expand over there. So that is readily accessible. There are other landowners along that stretch that are on board that are at this point saying, yes, let's do this. It could get much, much, much more expensive in the future depending on what happens.
May I add one clarifier?
Absolutely, please.
And as Madam Chair and Senators realize, if the city would expend those funds for right-of-way acquisition, we would never be reimbursed for MnDOT. So it's hard for a community of our size to put down $1.8 million. That is one-fifth of our annual levy, and that would be a huge burden upon our residents. So thank you.
Thank you. Another demonstration of significant need and great merit. Thank you. Appreciate it. Members, any other questions on this measure? Appreciate your time and sharing this story with us.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Scalzi, thank you for your patience. I know you have testifiers with site plan bonding and appropriation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for hearing this bill, and we will try to be brief.
Are we going to start with TCAP first?
Yes, we will. It's Senate File 180 and 181,
yes,
which is the TCAP site. And we're doing this two ways, either redevelopment bonds or cash, because who knows what's going to happen here at the end of this session. We want to be prepared. These bills are for a road development in the former TCAP site in Arden Hills. TCAP means Twin Cities Army and Ammunition Plant. So during World War II, there was every day a city of 40,000 people on this site making bullets and washing the machinery with trichloroethylene. So what happened was when the plant closed, and you'll hear a little bit about that from the mayor, Ramsey County is in the process of cleaning it up, and it's ready for development. And in your packet is a map of the area, and I hope you have the pretty colored map like this. It's a little over a mile long. It's a large site, and Freeway 35W is what you see on the left. It's ready for development. It's almost totally cleaned up. In the last legislative session, we were able to procure funding for two bridges on 35W, the Highway 96 bridge and the County Road H bridge. One is on the bottom, Highway 96, and on the top, upper level, is County Road H bridge to be constructed this summer and next. This funding proposal is for the mile-long spine road, and it's in the process of being designated as a county road. It's a little over a mile long, and it connects two county roads, and so the request is now going to the Mileage Committee of the Screening Board, and you probably know about that type of designation. So with me here today, I have Beth Ingham, who is the property manager for Ramsey County Public Works. I have David Grant, the mayor of Arden Hills, and Blake Huffman, Ramsey County Commissioner. So with that, Ms. Chair, we would turn it over to Beth. Excuse me.
Madam Chair and Senators, let me briefly just share our vision at the property when we acquired it two-plus years ago. Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Blake Huffman. Our goals were simple. Our goals were first to clean up the property. And that cleanup, by the way, I want to let you know, within 60 to 90 days, that cleanup will be done. And the biggest Superfund site in Minnesota will be cleaned up to residential standards. And so that's a great win for the entire state of Minnesota. Our other visions for the property were simple, and that was to make sure we brought in a significant and diverse tax base to make sure we brought in significant, good-paying jobs, and to do something creative and smart with the energy to make it sustainable. And that's why we're here today asking for the road to be built. Those last three things I mentioned are all dependent on this road being built. The numbers that we're looking at now show once this road is built, the property tax revenue alone will be $15 million in that range annually between all the different jurisdictions. We still believe, talking with all the different marketing folks out there, all the different greater MSP and chambers, that there'll be 4,000 good-paying jobs out there. And then probably the most exciting thing that's happening on the site, and it's real time, is the 427-acre site of TCAP, or Rice Creek Commons, as we now call it, is proposed right now to be net zero from an energy standpoint. Be the largest net zero development in Minnesota, one of the largest ones in the entire country, and we can do that through a variety of ways that I won't take the time to share now. But that road that we're talking about today is critical for those three things to happen.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Grant?
I'll just tell you a little bit, committee. I'm Beth Angham. I'm with Ramsey County Public Works. Just a little bit more about this fine road. It will be a four-lane divided roadway on a CASA system, as Senator Scalzi mentioned. The total project cost for the construction is $10 million. This roadway will connect two county roads and be the main roadway to provide access to all of the commercial, retail, and residential development on the 427 acres. It will carry, when the site is all developed, it will carry about 25,000 cars per day. And it will be designated, or already has been designated, as an A minor arterial expander.
Mayor Grant?
Right. Thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, my name is David Grant. I'm the mayor of Arden Hills. As you may know, the city of Arden Hills has been in the process of putting this land back into productive use since 2002, when the General Services Administration declared 427 acres as surplus property. The city's land use plan supports a mixed-use development and substantial increase in jobs and tax base. The city is nearly complete with the zoning and land use plan. And we're collaborating with Ramsey County in terms of infrastructure design and engineering. The Joint Development Authority of Arden Hills and Ramsey County is established and is preparing to issue a request for proposals for the first phase of development. As indicated earlier, within a couple of months, this site will be completely cleaned up and the largest Superfund site in the state will no longer be a Superfund site. We have received substantial interest from both commercial and residential developers, and this project is essential to be completed in this market cycle in order to continue the momentum that we see in the marketplace. The Spine Road provides access, as you can tell from the map, to the entire site, and it helps enable the private investment to proceed. Securing funding for the Spine Road will allow the city and the county to finalize plans for utility and stormwater infrastructure construction. The city of Arden Hills looks at this site as a 427-acre economic engine, if you will. If you looked at this site as a city of its own, believe it or not, it would not be the smallest city in Ramsey County. And I say that just so that we understand the economic impact that this area can have. And given its location, I think is the reason that's driving the very strong interest by developers. And along with Ramsey County, we look forward to bringing good, high-paying jobs to the area. Thank you.
Senator Scalzi. Sorry. Senator Scalzi, go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I can just fill in a little time here. This site had previously been considered for the Viking Stadium. You may have read about this. And then we sort of lost that battle to Minneapolis, but we want to make sure that we get this right, and we've been working on this for a number of years, and we're ready to go.
Thank you. Seeing as part of my district is in Ramsey County, I am obviously very familiar with it. I had the great pleasure to be out there when the big golden wrecking ball came down on the building, and it is a really impressive area, and I think it's going to be an amazing thing, and I was really excited to see the news about the energy projects and how successful that looks. So thank you for bringing this to us.
That energy project, by the way, if they can produce all their energy that they need, because they're talking about a 40 to 60 acre solar garden, and also all of the water that's coming up out of the earth in the geothermal heat coming up out of the earth, and it's now being, because that's how they're cleaning the water, that can be used to heat the areas. It's a pretty exciting project.
It is.
That's been in the works for quite a while.
And it's an amazing opportunity in the midst of such an already developed region and area. So
yes, thank you.
All right, members, any other questions about this? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Scalzi, I drive this every day. Every day, because I come from the north and Highway 10 through here. And I learned as the construction went from 694-10, that area, I learned about I and 3 and 96. And I sometimes even ended up in the munitions dump because I tried to find a way, went in, turned around, and came back out. So Lexington and Victoria and all those. Every 6 months, you'd have to learn a little bit of a new way to kind of get through the situation. And then I thought I had, wow, they finished it. And then they opened up 35 South to St. Paul. So just moved. I'm grateful for the construction because I know that's a brightness in the future, especially with the dump site and everything here. It's really fun to see that long history and to see it coming and being restored and getting something good. I just kind of I think an obvious practical question because there's four bills. I added it up. So though 6.5 is mentioned in two separate bills, it's one ask for 6.5 and one ask for 2.25, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. That's the only thing, and congratulations and all the hard work. I hope all that comes to fruition. I can see why it should because of its proximity to major thoroughfare and also residential. So wish you well.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. And with that, we will proceed on to Senate Files 182 and 183, the 694 Rice Street Interchange, another perennial conversation.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And as Senator Kiffmeyer always talks, and I really appreciate that, she drives through this area. So she's very aware of the second bill, which leads into this other area that we just talked about. These bills would fund the replacement of the Rice Street Bridge over Freeway 694. One if bonding, one if cash. As I said, we have no idea what's happening at the end of session this year. I also had this bill in 2011 when I was in the House. Mm-hmm. And Marty and Chamberlain were the Senate authors at that time. This bridge was promised to be replaced in 2004 and was actually on the list, on the MnDOT list. And then MnDOT asked the area if we would wait until the weave was completed and also all of the work at Snelling and 10 to the west. So currently, what you have in your packet is a design from about 10 years ago. It was a major cloverleaf, and Ramsey County would like to update that design to fit the needs of today. That was 10 years ago. So what's happening today is with the Unweave the Weave, which is 12 lanes of freeway going straight east to your district, and they feed into this one pinch point. And in this 12 lanes going to the east, MnDOT has built 5 bridges in the last 5 years. That was Unweave the Weave. That's completed. So you can go to Wisconsin, you can go to Duluth, and you can go right through these cities. And then in the same time frame, they built at least 5 bridges to the west. These are all brand-new bridges. It's a wonderful thing. This Rice Street Bridge only will accommodate 2 lanes under it. So with all of this massive concrete, we stripe the concrete and no one can use it. So people are driving on 2 lanes because 4 lanes come in. And this is what we've talked about in the past. Senator Kiffmeyer knows because she sits there and wonders why she can't use that concrete.
Oh, I know why.
and you know, a lot of people do. They shouldn't, but they do. I was looking through my file today, and I discovered letters from 2011 from letters of support from Land O'Lakes, who has 1,500 employees at their headquarters, Boston Scientific, 1,000 employees at Deluxe. Cummins Power Generation at that time had 1,800 employees. These people have sent us letters of support, including all the cities there, Shoreview, Vadnais Heights, and Little Canada. They can't get through that pinch point, and they're just very frustrated. It's been a long time. So this is the least that the state can do for the businesses in that area, and Ramsey County has stepped up to the plate, and so we have the same. We're trying to be real efficient with your time here. We have similar testifiers. So, okay.
Again, Commissioner. Commissioner Huffman, and I'll even be briefer this time. Senator Kiffmeyer, you mentioned the roadblocks you have coming in. Rice Street serves as a freeway alternative. It goes north and south. A lot of people take it into St. Paul. And as I go and visit businesses in my district, the northern part of Ramsey County, every one of them is hiring or wants to hire, and everyone is challenged with all the construction or the traffic delays related to the Rice Street Bridge. So I know we'll talk more about specific employers here in just a moment, but would really encourage you to fund this from an employer standpoint as well as a way of life for the citizens in that area.
Ms. Engel?
Yes.
Committee, I just wanted to add that.
And if you could please reintroduce yourself just for the record.
Excuse me, Beth Engel with Ramsey County Public Works. I just wanted to add that the current bridge is a bottleneck for Rice Street. As Blake Huffman mentioned, it is a reliever to go north-south in that area. Currently, the existing bridge does not accommodate turn lanes, so this new bridge would. But importantly as well, it would accommodate pedestrian facilities because there currently is no way for pedestrians to get north and south over 694 in this area. So the new bridge would also allow for a full shoulder on that 694 general purpose lane because right now the shoulder that's being designed is going to have to be substandard to fit beneath the existing bridge.
Welcome
Chair,
to the committee.
Members of the committee. My name is Ling Becker. I'm the executive director for the Vadnais Heights Economic Development Corporation. We represent over 100 businesses in Vadnais Heights and the surrounding areas. In addition to Vadnais Heights, I know the cities of Little Canada, Shoreview, Arden Hills, North Oaks, their businesses are just as interested in this bridge as our Vadnais businesses are. Some of the things that Senator Scalzi had said, you know, we've had businesses send writing letters to senators and representatives for over 10 years about this project. And in reference to what Commissioner Huffman said, you know, jobs are something that this bridge is about, and it's going to be very challenging for these businesses. And we've had one say that they're waiting to expand, waiting to grow because of issues related to this bridge. And I think any investment in this bridge is much needed for our area, for our businesses, and certainly residents and commuters would be up here probably testifying too. But on behalf of the business community, we just really would encourage that the committee, you know, support this bridge.
Thank you.
And thank Senator you, Ms. Scalzi. Chair. And so these bills are for the design and environmental studies necessary for the replacement. They were done in 2005, but they'd have to be redone with new design.
Thank you. Members, any questions?
Senator
Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, on this particular section, when they were doing that, they did a new process, which I think is neat to hear about, how they built the overpass or the bridge, whatever they call it, the deck, off to the side, and to minimize the disruption of traffic. And then in a short period of time, they moved it into place. It was really amazing to see how they've done some of these things. There have been some other places as well, I think, even on the – so it's nice to see the benefits and the focus on not disrupting traffic anymore. It's bad enough, and the construction is hard, but looking forward to seeing this done as well.
Yes, it's great to see projects where they're looking at efficiencies in the full sense of the word and how it affects the communities as well.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and members. If you have any other further questions, I can be reached.
Thank you.
Thank you
all
so much
for being here.
Thank
you. All right, next we will go back to Senators Newman and Ortman.
Questions.
Welcome to the committee. Senator Newman, I believe you're going first.
That's correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, regarding Senate File 261, that is the bill that I have brought forward, this bill wholly involves the funding for some construction of Highway U.S. 212 in Carver County. McLeod County is my Senate district, and I've got three folks that I'm going to have very briefly explain to you why the completion of Highway U.S. 212 in Carver County, which is Senator Ortman's district, is so important to my constituents in McLeod County. I would like to draw your attention to a number of items that I have placed in your packet, which are resolutions supporting this project, and also some letters from folks in McLeod County who own businesses that feel the completion of Highway 212 in Carver County will benefit them. The three testifiers I'm going to ask to describe for you the benefit would be, first of all, City Administrator from the City of Glencoe, that's Mr. Mark Larson, the City Administrator from the City of Hutchinson, which is Matt Yannick, and then current McLeod County Commissioner and former State Representative Ron Szymanski, who would speak on behalf of McLeod County. And with that, Madam Chair, I would ask that Mr. Larson introduce himself and give the remarks regarding Glencoe.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mark Larson. I've been the city administrator in the city of Glencoe for the last 25 and a half years. A little history on 212. There is a four-lane section of 212 that goes from Carver County, Norwood Young America, to the city of Glencoe that was built about 45 years ago. Then it goes to single lane, and then around Cologne it's four lane, and then it becomes four lane again around Carver. It's been in the plan for over 50 years for the four lane to be completed from the metro to the city of Glencoe. Actually, it goes 2 miles to the west of the city limits of the city of Glencoe. Currently, we have some major manufacturers and distribution companies in the city of Glencoe. First is Seneca, which is the world's largest vegetable processing plant. They currently do corn and peas under the Green Giant label. They are adding a line of carrots soon. Archer Daniels Midland, Allied Nutrition, is a feed products manufacturer in Glencoe. Archer Daniels Midland is now investing $15 million in a new plant expansion, which is going to double their expansion in Glencoe. We also have Miller Manufacturing, which is farm, ranch, and pet products. In 2007, they came to Glencoe, bought the old Nordic Track building with 40 employees. They are now up over 300 employees and added 100,000 square feet last year to distribution. There will be a real economic impact to the city of Glencoe if the four lane is completed in Carver County. If you look at cities that are about 40 miles, 30 to 40 miles north, south, and east of the Twin Cities, where we're situated 40 miles to the west, the economic impact of those cities by having four-lane major highways has been tremendous. There's also safety impact. There are very poor sight lines on the two-lane sections, and it's very difficult to pass on those sections. And the city of Glencoe supports this wholeheartedly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd invite Mr. Yannick, City Administrator from the City of Hutchinson, to come forward.
Welcome, Mr. Yannick.
Madam Chair, committees, or members of the committee, my name is Matt Yannick. I'm the City Administrator for the City of Hutchinson. I'm here on behalf of the Hutchinson City Council. Obviously, when we talk about this proposed bill, it's really a regional impact, and for us in Hutchinson, I'm here to touch on that. We're roughly about 40 miles west of where this project is going to take place, but Highway 212 is really the primary connector for our interstate roadway. Our local paper actually did a study a couple years ago regarding cities over the population of 10,000. They looked at five states in the upper Midwest, from Minnesota, Wisconsin, North and South Dakota, and Iowa. There are over 235 communities that have a population of 10,000 or more. Of those communities, only six don't have a four-lane highway. Hutchinson is one of those six. We call ourselves the the Minnesota manufacturing city. It's not just a logo. Roughly over 30% of our population is employed in the field of manufacturing. That's more than double the state average and more than three times the national average. We've got the 3M plant in Hutchinson. It's the largest in North America. If you use 3M tape, most likely it's come from the city of Hutchinson. On top of that, we have over 30 other manufacturers that ship products throughout the entire United States. Obviously, this is a big impact for the city of Hutchinson, for our manufacturers, for our business community, and we're here to wholeheartedly support the proposals that are being brought forth by Senator Newman and Senator Ortman.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Szymanski.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ron Szymanski, McLeod County Commissioner, and I'd like to also speak in support of this bill. This is something that I've advocated since my term in the House back in 2007. MnDOT had completed the expansion of, or the bypass reconstruction of Highway 212 from Carver to Eden Prairie. And at that time, we recognized the advantage of having a four-lane highway contiguously extending into western Minnesota. And so at that time, I began advocating for this project, and I'm glad to see it here before the Senate Transportation Committee. McLeod County Board did pass a resolution in support of this project. We would like to see Highway 212 four-laned all the way into McLeod County and beyond if possible. But it not only represents the communities of Glencoe and Hutchinson, but also the economic impact for the farm commodities that are transported to the metro area, and likewise the retail commodities that are coming out to our communities, to our big box stores and our local retailers as well. And I look at this as not an earmark project, but it's time to prioritize the necessity here. I would also like to point out is throughout the metro area, there are many four-lane highways that, spread out into central Minnesota. This area in Senator Newman's district and McLeod County is the only area not served by a four-lane highway from the metro area heading into western Minnesota. So I do ask for your solid consideration of this project. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, that completes the testifiers. But before I turn this matter over to Senator Ortman, I wonder if it would be okay. There are a couple of more people from my area. If they could simply come forward, identify themselves in support of this.
Absolutely.
This project, if that
be glad
be.
To hear from them for the record.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senate members. My name is Kevin Dietz. I'm currently with the City of Glencoe City Council in my first term. Before that, I retired from the Glencoe Police Department. I had almost 27 years service with the police department. You look at the economic benefit of Highway 212. I believe this has been on the books as a proposal since maybe 1940s, which is 20 years more than I've been here. So it's been a long time that this has been thought about. So the economic benefit is tremendous, not only to the city of Chaska, to Carver County, McLeod County, Hutchinson, Glencoe, Renville County, all the way out to Granite Falls. There are a lot of worthy projects presented today, and I look at this one. This one takes in the whole southwest portion of the state. I mean, this is huge. There are so many trucks that are up and down that road every day. I look from the public safety point of view, how many crashes I've gone to on 212, how many people that have been hurt on 212, how many have been injured, how many improvements have been made, but still with improvements, things do happen. And that's the unfortunate thing. But you look at going from Chaska towards Cologne, you go down to a two-lane. Cologne, you go to a four-lane. West of Cologne, you go to a two-lane. And then you go back to a four-lane at Norwood. It's just the up-and-down speed. 212 had been increased to 60 miles an hour to the west of Glencoe, but not any in Carver County. So it's just also a safety point of view that I look at. The serious accidents and everything else that can happen. So I do appreciate your time. I didn't know I was going to testify until I got here, so thank you for allowing me the time.
We're glad to hear from you. Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Steve Cook, and I served as mayor of Hutchinson from 2005 until 2014. This was a priority project while I was in office. It was a priority project for the previous mayor, who had been a longtime mayor, and it's a priority for the current mayor, who unfortunately can't be here tonight. Again, a lot of testimonies talked about the benefits, and it's not just even for McLeod County, but it's to the communities to the west, including Olivia, Granite Falls, and even the city of Marshall. Improvements that were done to the east and Eden Prairie to Carver, they weren't the end. They were the start of the project, and I just want to thank Senator Newman and Senator Ortman for their bills to help get the next phase done. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point, I would defer to Senator Ortman for presentation of her bill.
Very quickly, Senator Osmick, did you want to ask a question?
Yes, before? For Senator Newman.
Thank
Senator
you
Newman, you knowing my background, isn't it getting Glencoe and Hutchinson to agree to something sort of one of the signs of the apocalypse? I grew up in Biscay for 18 years. And I was a Glencoe Eagle, and getting these two communities to actually agree upon something is one of the signs that we should all cash in our life insurance policies, as far as I'm concerned.
Madam Chair, it's groundbreaking.
Perhaps it's a sign that we need to take all these things very seriously. Senator Ortman, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. I am here as an advocate for Highway 212, its expansion and its improvements. It is a vital need in my community and throughout western Minnesota all the way to the South Dakota border. And my understanding is it was the first designed to go out to the South Dakota border pre-World War II. So this highway has been on the list of unmet needs for decades and decades. The 10-mile stretch from Eden Prairie to Chaska through Chanhassen was a huge improvement. It changed everything in Carver County. But the advocates continue because the road is not complete. And we could have filled this room easily with people that have gone well out of their way to advocate for the improvements of this road. And I think every one of you who has served with me for more than a year or two knows of my strong advocacy for Highway 212. It is a safety issue. It's a transportation issue. It's an economic development issue. If you traveled any time recently, well, within the last 10 years, to the western side of my district and went through Norwood Young America to see what has happened because of the lack of development in that community, because the road ends in Cologne. And so all of the communities west of there are really suffering with the need for having decent transportation. And I've served on this committee as well. I know there are challenges, especially Senator Kiffmeyer. I heard your concerns. But this is the year for transportation at the Capitol, if there ever was one. And you all sit in great seats of opportunity to make sure that transportation is a priority here at the state Capitol. And so we are all trusting. That's why we're all here today, to make sure we highlight the great need and empower you to do what you can to fund these very important projects. As I said, there are several folks here from my community as well that stand in support of Senator Newman's bill, as well as mine. And in particular, I would like to point out that we have Lyndon Robjan, who's not on the list, but he is the Carver County engineer that can speak to the history of this project and can also speak to the needs and the engineering behind these projects. And then we have with me the mayor of Chaska, and Mayor Winchittle is also a fireman, and so he listened very, very patiently through those conversations. He had much that he could have added, but we are persistent and patient, if nothing else, from Carver County, and we have sat through these hearings hoping that we would get our chance. We also have from our Chamber of Commerce, Lori Anderson, who can speak about the economic development aspects of expanding Highway 212. And then there are other advocates here as well. We have the city administrator from Chaska, and we also have County Commissioner Randy Maluchnik, And we have one of the advocates for 212 as well that you know, Margaret, as well. So with that, I will turn things over to the mayor who would like to speak next. And then, for sure, any questions that you might have, please stop us at any time. As I said, our engineer is here as well.
And if I can just interject very quickly, because it's two bills, we've doubled the time, but we do have about 6 minutes left if we can try to keep it a little streamlined. But okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And, yes, I am a 38-year career volunteer and paid on-call firefighter, retired now. But so I did listen to a lot. And my father was a line-of-duty death that didn't get any benefits. So I listened a lot to that. So, but anyways, I'd just like to start by saying thank you for allowing us to be here. You can see 212 means a lot to a lot of us. We have a lot of people here supportive of it. And what we're looking at is an interchange at the intersection of Highway, or County Road 140 and 212. And that'll open up nearly 500 acres of land that will allow us to change it from residential to corporate industrial development. We currently have an area of about 250 acres that employs 4,000 to 5,000 people. So we see this as a large job area for us by allowing us to get this proper funding for this. But it also maximizes the investment. We talked about the 212 being done from Eden Prairie to Chaska. And we can utilize the existing structure. What we're looking for is about $8 million. Wow, that's a lot of money. I realize that. But a normal intersection is about $20 million. But we can utilize the existing structures that are there, and a lot of things are already in place. We already have design approval by DOT and the Met Council. So we're all ready to go. The last key piece that we are missing is the funding. So that's where we're looking here. We certainly hope that you support our bill. And I want to thank Senators Ortman and Newman for sponsoring this. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Lori Anderson. I'm the president of the Southwest Metro Chamber of Commerce. The Southwest Metro Chamber encompasses Chaska, Chanhassen, Victoria, and Carver. One of our large things that we do in our mission is to be business advocate and also to create regional prosperity. And we truly believe that the expansion of 212 as well as the interchange would definitely fit into the criteria that our mission demonstrates through the Chamber of Commerce. Our board is in full support of the bill, and we hope that you consider that in your decision making.
Thank you, and thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Lyndon Robgen, Carver County Engineer. Real quick, I know we've got about 2 minutes. From an engineer's perspective, I just want to congratulate the city on the study they've done on this interchange. If you look at the number, $8 million, this is kind of the new way of doing things, as you all know. Find the lowest cost solution with the highest benefit to the project that you can possibly do, and I think they've done a great job with this. So if you look at this area, Chaska, there's tremendous growth, like the mayor mentioned. And there's a lot of county roads in the area that are impacted by that. And our most important route is if you go to the Taste of Minnesota this year, which is July 2nd through 5th, you'll probably travel on Highway 10, which is the most important county highway in Carver County. The projected traffic on that road is about 40,000 vehicles a day, which is more than 212 to the south, the two lane that we're talking about. That's more than Highway 5 to the north, which is a two-lane section. Incredibly important highway. What this project does at 140 is it directly relieves our Engler Boulevard, which, again, is our most important route. Without the interchange or new access at 212, the interchange at Engler Boulevard and 212 would not work in the long term with that kind of traffic. So we're highly supportive of this. The great thing about it is it's an incredibly low cost for what we're getting. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Senators,
you,
any final comments?
No, I would just say you're in a position to have a great amount of influence in the outcome of this budget. We do have a surplus. There are funds, and I hope that you will do all you can to ensure that new funding is identified for road and bridge projects across the state. It is a huge priority for my entire district, for Senator Newman's district, and well beyond out to the border. May we add
Madam
one more?
Yes,
thing,
absolutely.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Senator Ortman. Before we left, I wanted to talk about, if I could, being an engineer again. You mentioned the local bridge fund earlier. That is a massively important fund for all counties and cities. The problem with that fund is although the legislature puts in money in it regularly, which we thank you, it's a very good program because it's first come, first serve. Counties get about 50%, and they put 50% of their own money in. Problem is there's no money left. All the money is gone. We have bridges on our waiting list. We have a bridge actually downtown Chaska where we closed half the roadway because it's so bad. So there's a huge amount of projects on the waiting list, but there's no money left. So we encourage you to fill that bonding part again, whether it's surplus money or new bonding, this session if possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make a comment. There, one thing I've seen in listening through 3 days' worth of bills, and it has never been a concern to me of the quality of the projects or the need for the projects. One thing I have known is everybody here at this table and everybody else, both in the House and the Senate, has seen that roads, bridges, these kinds of construction things are one of the first duties of government. It's the one thing that all of us in so many ways benefit from. And so I'm encouraged by that. And I've also seen, though, that every single year we have seen the pot refilled. Sometimes there have been exceptional circumstances that require exceptional situations. But I know that everybody around this table does have a concern for that and does do our very best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well said. Senator Westrum, you had a question.
Madam Chair, I appreciate hearing about the 212 project and just echo what Senator Kiffmeyer and others have said. Is there anybody from the Glencoe area here yet? It relates to 212, and recently at some meetings I've been at, I've heard different anecdotal evidence about costs that are driving up the cost of doing road construction, and that is environmental review of roads that already exist. And the person that was bringing the example up referred to Glencoe or the that area, and I wondered if you had any experience with cost drivers from environmental review that make sense or doesn't make sense in what we would look at reforming to help bring costs down of doing actual road projects, if you have any comment on that.
I really don't know.
Maybe you don't know anything about it.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
You have? Okay. No. Just a comment, Madam Chair, I guess, just in generally, anybody that has that insight, you know, one of the things is more money, but the other thing is what can we do with the current projects to stretch dollars and this example that I've had brought up different times is environmental review of a road that's already existing is different than doing an environmental review of a road that's going to be going in someplace new. And the why we would spend a lot of money studying where a road already is just not a good use of taxpayer dollars. And I think that has to be part of the discussion that maybe is not being spoke about as much as we should.
Yes.
Madam Chair, first on 212, the environmental process that the Senator referred to, that's all complete on this section of our project. So we've actually got a federal document done, and we have an official map. It took us years and years to get there. Streamlining the permitting process would definitely be a way to reduce cost. Allowing the Bowser Wetland Replacement Bank to be replenished would reduce cost, because without that, local agencies have to provide their own mitigation. So there's a lot of environment. Those are just two small examples.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Senator Franzen. Senator Franzen, do you want to start with Senate File 268 for 62, Highway 62?
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. You know, sometimes being in this position, you can bring your own ideas forward, and this was a solo proposition, but certainly something that's been discussed in my district and around my district. So Highway 62, you have a handout. You hopefully all know where it is, because if you've been to the airport, you most likely have either traveled on it or have been very close to it. So it's one of the main arteries to our airport, and coming from the western suburbs in the district that I represent in Edina all the way to St. Paul, it's a road that I actually, highway that I take every day to come to the Capitol. And we know that we are not only increasing population, but certainly we have more traffic on our roads, and this is nonetheless one of those pinch points and bottlenecks that prevent us for, you know, getting to and from work and commerce and so forth. So this bill came out of an idea the City of Richfield actually presented in Edina about a year ago and brought the idea forward, as well as this area has a lot of the right-of-way already purchased or already access to that right-of-way that would be necessary to expand Highway 62 for one more lane on each direction. So I've talked to stakeholders. I've talked to the City of Richfield. I've talked to the City of Edina. Certainly we'd try to be here today, but everyone has busy schedules, so I was not able to bring them forward. But certainly have received a lot of support for this idea. Actually, speaking with MnDOT, I know that right now, even Commissioner Zelli, it's on their radar. They're doing a study right now, and they're in that phase. It's not complete yet, but it certainly brought attention to this corridor. And I also had the ability to not only move this idea forward, but also have the support of Senator Hand, which for me was a very important stakeholder to bring forward, too, because he does represent the western suburbs, and his district would be benefited by this construction of this highway. So certainly a bipartisan move forward to fund our roads and bridges, and in this case, a very vital transportation corridor for our metro area. The range of the project is between 180 and 240 million. So there was actually a fiscal note drafted because I wanted to know how much this would cost if most of the right of way is already purchased and it's already in existence. So the midpoint range of this project would be about 210 million. And I think to put it in perspective of how important that corridor is to go not only to the airport, but to the Mall of America and to St. Paul and all the different areas in Metro. Certainly an investment that would have a high return on investment. So that is what I have for you today, members. I wanted to bring this idea forward, know that it's still being explored, and actually it's come to the attention of MnDOT to potentially do a MnPass lane. So I'm certainly open to that. I've talked to Suburban Transit in the past, and they are open to having that discussion as well, because there's a lot of opportunity there to get more buses and transit flowing through that area. So that is the bill, the bonding proposal in front of you. I can take questions, but I wanted to keep it short and sweet given our time.
Thank you, Senator Franzen. Question, members? Well, thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you're ready, we can move to Senate File 926.
Yes, whenever you're ready.
I do have an entourage for that one. Members, this is a proposal 926 for bonding for benefiting the I-494 ramp at East Bush Lake Road. This bill in front of us today was brought to me from the City of Bloomington, one of their priorities for this year. They are seeking funds to build a westbound ramp on I-94 and East Bush Lake Road. Although the city is advancing the request, it is also supported by the I-494 Corridor Commission. Bloomington, Edina, Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, and Richfield are all part of that. Westbound ramp at this intersection would relieve traffic problems in the area and assist in a smoother operation of the already congested interchange of I-494 and Highway 100. The interchange has actually been without a westbound ramp on I-494 connections since the original construction in 1960. And over the years, high-density development has occurred in Bloomington and at this location. It's home to one of the fastest-growing spaces in the metro, the Normandale Lakes Office Park, second after downtown Minneapolis. And as the land area north in Edina and South Bloomington continue to redevelop and densify, the new on-ramp will give the needed capacity for the additional traffic volumes. This project has multiple stakeholders and funding sources, including MnDOT, Edina, Bloomington, and Hennepin County. And additionally, many other project delivery requirements have already been completed to assist in expediting project delivery. The total request to the state has been reduced since the bill was first introduced, which is always good news. The original was of $20 million, and we've been able to reduce it to only $4.5 million to help complete this important project. And with me today, I have Shelley Peterson from the Bloomington City Engineer to further describe the project and an additional testifier as well. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Shelley Peterson, as she said, Bloomington City Engineer. Senator Franson was very thorough on her description, and I will be brief, so as we are very late in your afternoon. As we said, there is land north and south of here in Bloomington and Edina that is ripe for more high-density development, bringing employment into the area. What that brings congestion. This will help relieve the congestion so that we can maybe spur on the development in the area. The project is ready. We have been working diligently on it so it can be delivered efficiently and effectively. And I guess with that, I would just close and ask if there's any questions.
Members, you also have a map of the project, too, for a visual and some more description.
Thank you. Mr. Rudling, were you going to testify as well?
We could move Thank you, Madam Chair and members. In the interest of time, I will waive testimony.
All right. Members, any questions about this project or proposal? Senator Franzen?
That's all I have, unless members have questions. But certainly, we like the fiscal note, and it's certainly something a good problem to have when it gets reduced. So I hope people the members in the committee can support it and look forward to working with you to make these projects happen with this session.
Thank you very much, Senator Franzen, and to both of your testifiers for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Next, last but not least, Senator Wicklund, staying in the West Metro. And it's nice that you can share testifiers.
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The first bill I have, it's Senate File 296. This is the I-35W, I-494, Phase 1, the turbine interchange improvements. The bill that you have in front of you was brought to me by the City of Bloomington. They're seeking funds to improve the intersection of I-35W and 494. And although the City of Bloomington advanced the request, the project is supported by many in the region, including the I-494 Corridor Commission, which includes the cities of Bloomington, Edina, Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, and Richfield, and the I-35W Solutions Alliance, which includes Bloomington, Burnsville, Elko, Newmarket, Lakeville, Minneapolis, Richfield, Savage, and Dakota, Hennepin, and Scott counties. This interchange is the busiest and one of the most congested and unsafe intersections in Minnesota. It was designed almost 60 years ago, and in that time has seen very few significant improvements. It's now over capacity and carries approximately 500,000 vehicles per day. If you happen to travel this route on a regular basis, you won't be surprised to learn that the I-494 commute is ranked as the 17th worst commute in the United States. Contrast this to the fact that approximately 21% of metro area jobs are located along the I-494 corridor, which has consistently been an area of economic growth and strength. Long term, we know this is a very big project. Early designs were estimated to cost nearly $500 million. However, the new design is much more affordable and could be built in phases. The first phase, which resolves the majority of the traffic issues, can be built for $65 million. Phase one of the turbine interchange improvements would include rerouting traffic, rebuilding 82nd Street Bridge over I-35W and constructing access from northbound I-35 to westbound I-494. And to give you all more details on what the turbine interchange would mean for this area, I have Shelley Peterson here, the Bloomington City Engineer.
Welcome again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to go into a little bit more detail, obviously, through this interchange, we take 75,000 commuters a day. We take goods and services. So this is very much economic-driven for this interchange for Minnesota, because there's a lot of people driving not just short commutes but long commutes and long hauls for goods and services also. It has regional significance in Minnesota. And doing the phase one of the turbine design, we have a fancy name also. Doing the phase one will begin to relieve the congestion and reduce accidents. This is also one of the top accident generators on the freeway system. So we have, like I said, multiple supporters. We have done a lot of work on the project already with our partners and stakeholders so that there is a lot of the groundwork has been laid and ready to move the project forward quickly.
Great.
Madam Chair,
Senator Wicklund.
I would also point out that there's been close work done with those working on the bus rapid transit line along 35W, and there's hope that some of the work can be done at the same time so that creating less disruption coming back to it later. So,
very good. Yes, I live on the eastern end of 494, so I'm well familiar with it. All right. Members, any questions on this proposal? Thank you.
I wonder what happened to her foot.
Oh.
I was actually rock climbing.
Oh. Oh. That's a very good adventurous answer.
Yeah. Really.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. All right. Senator Wicklund, do you want to move on to Senate File 245?
Yes, I would. Senate File 245 is a bonding request for funding for the Mall of America Transit Station. This Mall of America Transit Station is actually the busiest transit station in the state of Minnesota, even more so than Target Field or Union Depot transit stations. If you've ever visited the transit station, then you've likely noticed that this station is badly in need of efficiency and operational improvements. For example, all the buses need to go through the same security gate as contractors who are required to have their steering wheels swiped for explosives. This can lead to very long lines for buses and others entering the mall, increasing the time it takes to ride transit. Considering the lengths we go to reduce the length of transit trips, this seems like an unacceptable situation. The station is also in need of exterior improvements. This transit station is amongst the first impressions of many who visit Minnesota, and the existing aesthetics are, well, abysmal is the word that's I could use. It's not a very pretty place. There's no exterior signage that directs visitors to this transit station. If you come from outside of the mall, you really have to kind of guess which entrance should I go in or where could I go to find where the buses and the light rail end up. The station is connected to one of the biggest tourist attractions in the state, connected to thousands of jobs, and an area with significant economic development and power and potential. There is also a timeline crunch for this project. The project needs funding this year in order to have the construction completed and the station operational in time for the 2018 Super Bowl and the later 2019 Final Four. The airport, the mall, and Bloomington area hotels will be flooded with visitors during this event, and having the Mall of America Transit Station improvements completed in time is a high priority for the city of Bloomington and I think for the whole region to have a good experience with these big events in our area. In total, it's a $26 million project. We have many funding partners committed. The CMAQ, Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Grants distributed by the Met Council, Dakota County, Mall of America, and City of Bloomington and the Port Authority have all committed various amounts of money. And we've also been able to reduce the request, the bonding request, by $5 million since the introduction of the bill. So it would be a $10 million bonding request. And I have Shane Redling today, who is the Bloomington Port Authority Administrator, to tell you more.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Once again, this is a project that's well down the tracks, pun intended. We've been working with our stakeholders, Met Transit, Dakota County, and others to move the project along, and in May we'll be issuing a design RFP with that group. So this, while it isn't shovel-ready today, it will be shovel-ready. We need to get this done before 2018. And once again, just to echo what Senator Wicklund mentioned about the station, this is the busiest transit station in the state of Minnesota by any metric, bar none, period, and it literally does not have a sign outside, not even a metal sign or any exterior presence whatsoever. And if you've ever been there, I think you'd agree that it isn't the impression that Minnesota wants to give to a lot of first visitors to the state. In addition to all that, it's just functionally obsolete. And with that, I'll keep my testimony short and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Comments? See, it's easy when you wait so long. any additional comments, Senator Wicklund?
No, I'll just also point out that there are, in the future, up to 4 arterial bus rapid transit lines will be using this station. So we're projecting that will grow in use and popularity. And so I think this project really needs to happen sooner rather than later, and has a lot of important qualities to it. So
thank you. All right. Members, any questions, comments? Senator Dibble, anything before we conclude for the day?
No, Madam Chair. No, not many of us here.
The diehards.
So I don't think I had contemplated that we would work out Senator Jensen's bill on Friday. I don't think we need to do that. We're going to either do it behind the scenes, or we'll figure out we won't meet on Friday for that purpose.
What are you doing?
We are.
Can't hear you.
So we had proposed perhaps to work out Senator Jensen's bill on Friday, but we're not going to do that. We're going to work it out before or if it lands in the full finance committee. There's some questions. We're not going to come back and work it over on Friday. but we'll be rolling out the final version of the finance bill on Monday. Yeah, I know. I'm talking into the tape here, or all the people who are listening at home all across the state of Minnesota and internationally on the internet.
It's been such fun.
So we'll see the finance bill on Monday. I haven't quite figured out if we're going to do markup or if we're going to do markup the next. More likely we're going to roll out the final version of the bill. It won't be much different than the bill we've already seen, but it'll have the general fund targets and all of that in there, and then allow for markup the next day probably.
So we're not meeting on Friday?
Correct.
Not meeting Friday.
All right. That's all we got.
All right. Well, with that, the meeting is adjourned.